Welcome all. My name is John Conklin. In case you don't know that, I'm the chair here. Thank you all so much for coming. We have, as I've said, an agenda today that I think will allow us plenty of time for discussion if necessary. We're going to start off with just introductions or role in the room. I'm going to start, and I guess I won't take it personally that the four chairs to my right are empty. It's like in my law school class, I keep saying, come forward, sit closer. Anyways, I did shower this morning, but I'm going to start off with Stephen, and we'll just work around introductions, please. Thank you.
I'm Stephen Chagg, lead staff to the Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee.
Jose Guillen, Sonoma Superior Court.
Tammy Grimm, CEO, Imperial Superior Court.
Kevin Harrigan, CEO, Glenn Superior Court.
Rebecca Fleming, CEO, Stanislaus County Superior Court.
Leslie Holland, San Joaquin County.
Rick Feltzi, Napa Superior Court.
Paul Marigonda, Santa Cruz.
Joyce Feinrichs, Humboldt County.
Mark Cope, Riverside.
Sam Hamrick, CEO of Riverside Superior Court.
Mike Roddy, CEO in San Diego.
Jeff Barton, San Diego.
Sure.
Oh, Martin Hoshino, Administrative Director for the courts.
Zlatko Theodorovich, Director of Finance Judicial Council.
Mark Dustman, Acting Chief Administrative Officer for the courts.
Very good. Contra Costa.
Tanya Ugrin, Capo Bianco, El Dorado.
Chris Volker, San Bernardino.
Yeah, Ira Kaufman, Plumas. Jim Herman, Santa Barbara.
David Yamasaki, Santa Clara.
Sherry Carter, Los Angeles.
Carolyn Cool, Los Angeles.
Brian Taylor, Solano.
Thank you all. And on the phone?
Glenda Saunders, Orange County.
Jeff Brian Lewis, McCain. King. Sorry, Jeff. Go ahead.
Yes, Jeff Lewis, Kings County.
Brian McCabe, Merced.
Anybody else? I know Judge Earl was going to join us on the phone. She may be in session right now. Judge Earl, are you with us? All right, Judge Earl is not on yet. Have I left anybody out? All right, seeing none. I also, the minutes as part of your materials, the minutes from the November 24th, 2015 meeting have been distributed. I assume you've all read those precisely with great interest. Is there anybody that has a motion to approve the minutes?
I would move to approve the minutes.
Second, Yamasaki.
All right, moved and seconded. All in favor of approving the minutes, aye.
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 Any opposition? None. The minutes from November 2014 are approved. We do have public comment this morning, I'm told. We also have Mr. Hoshino with us, who has, unfortunately, a scheduling conflict. But I think we'll turn to the minutes very briefly, pardon me, to the public comment. There's one public comment. I want to make sure that person has an opportunity to be heard. And it's, is it? And I apologize. I just can't read the name. That's fine. If that's acceptable to you, then we'll table your comments till we get to the item. Thank you. I appreciate that very much. Therefore, we're now moving into the first discussion item, which is item one, the governor's proposed budget. And with us, we have Mr. Hoshino, who's introduced himself. I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Judge Conklin, and members of the committee, for the opportunity to be able to present to you, at least, at a very, very high level, the governor's proposed budget of January 7th. So on January 7th, the governor did, in fact, put out the proposal for the coming fiscal year, and we did have an internal conference call throughout the state with a lot of folks, and I presume a lot of you were at least on the phone. This is our opportunity to at least do it in person. Because there's a lot of detail in there, I'm not going to cover a lot of it. I do have Zlatko Theodorovich with us from our fiscal office, who will be here for a longer duration to be able to make more presentations as well as to answer questions. Because I want to go very quickly, I also want to have an opportunity to be able to answer your questions directly. So I'm going to go very quickly at a high level, and then if it pleases the committee to just generally stipulate to a lot of the items that I presented earlier and described to you on the telephone calls. And I am assuming and hopefully that the majority of folks were able to participate at least on those calls that we had on that Friday subsequent to the budget being released on January 7th. I want to start very quickly by thanking the members of the trial courts. There is a very long list of people, but in particularly Rick Feldstein and Judge McCabe, as well as Judge Conklin, and many of the trial courts that were making information available to us, sometimes in real time, sometimes without much time or notice whatsoever, as it is in a budget process to answer questions that are coming out and through it. It is another testament to a collective effort that everybody hustles to try and get information so that we can at least get a decent proposal to start to work with. Put the budget in state context. It is no surprise, and it's a bit of a refrain, that the governor of the administration continues to make proposals based on a theme that there is really no desire there. And in their view, the most responsible thing is to not overgrow state government, given what they see as the boom-bust pattern and cycle in California. And so the governor this year used the term of not increasing permanent spending in government, and he does this to advise and to acknowledge that we've had the largest growth period since a recession in 2008, and that he expects that another recession is in the near future, and the worst thing that we can do for California is to overgrow state government or grow it too quickly at a pace such that when that growth is combined with a recession, disastrous things happen for California. And so this theme of one-time revenues that we hear about and then potential one-time proposals is a theme that is riddled throughout this budget, and it is no different for us here at the branch itself. They do spend time putting more dollars into the rainy day fund in the reserve that is, again, consistent with their view of what the responsible thing is to manage the budgets of California. In the context for the branch received $146 million. This does not include $60 million in one-time deferred maintenance dollars. And of that $146 million, it represents probably about 30% of what I would characterize as $475 million worth of budget proposal requests. I don't include a budget proposal request in doing that math for you all. That was about $500 million that was seeking the return of one-time capital construction dollars that were swept in a previous budget cycle for the branch. Now, that might sound decent in terms of a proposal inside our world of 30% on the total amount of what we're requesting in terms of program and operations, but there is a gap in terms of what we believe to be our priorities for funding and what the governor's priorities for funding were that were outlined in that. And again, we went through all of the detail of those pieces, but I'm at least on a high level would suggest those things. We are now beginning process-wise next steps, what it all means. I think most folks are trying to react, trying to get more detail. The way the process works, which many people are already aware of, the governor proposes a budget. It's high on math. It has a lot of details with regard to dollars. And then there's language associated with the policies and the priorities that connect with those dollars. But there's also more language, more details of what specific proposals mean. And so we have been spending some time, at least at the staff level, trying to have more conversation with those folks. I can share some information with you about that, of what was meant by this part of the proposal or this particular part of the proposal and the like. Similarly, the Legislative Analyst Office then has a responsibility to react in response to the budget. So they've done so at least initially at a high level. And then they've also requested meetings with us and provided a list of questions for us to respond to as they react to the proposals that are out there. And so that process will continue. Certainly internally here at the branch, we have a lot of questions. Probably the questions are the same that you have, that we actually have. And we're collecting and cataloging all of those questions, asking people to spot the issues, so that we can continue the process that will culminate sometime in June, we hope. We're also meeting at the Judicial Council with some of the leadership of the council members to actually talk about, well, what happens next and get similar reactions there to formulate what it is as we go forward. As I close all of the calls, as I'll close my comments here, it is important and very valuable that to us that collectively we start to ask these questions and to figure out. A lot of the answers to the questions, as we all know, are going to be, I don't know. But together we have to figure out with input from everybody how it is that we proceed next on some of the items that are proposed in the budget. There are natural issues of, and I'll pick an example, there's an innovations grant fund program that is proposed in the governor's budget of $30 million, which is one-time funding. And we need to get a lot of detail and understand, you know, what that is and if that is in fact what happens in the month of July and we start, well, we have to figure out how it is we would actually implement or develop such a program. Right now the language is, as proposed, sufficient, but it simply says develop a program. That's a great place to start, but of course there are going to be a lot of devilish details to figure out what does that mean and how would you go about doing it, and we'll have to, again, include as many parties as we can to figure out what that means along the way. So with that, I am, again, just going to, I'm going to stop, even though I could go on and on and on and on, and I think I did on the calls for about 45 minutes or so, but I at least want to, before I leave, have to, an opportunity to answer any questions that any of the members may have.
With that, questions from anybody on the committee? Judge Gould?
I think we should all recognize Martin's contribution here in being able to speak to the governor in a way that expresses the needs of the branch. The structural changes, or the structural aspects of the proposed budget are extremely positive for the branch. The backfill of benefits, the backfill of the shortfall in trial court trust fund, which you achieved for us, and now is being carried forward. The change on the 2%, even the Phoenix funding, very, I think, creative way to help with the IMF. All of those are creative and positive, and I think we should thank Martin for that. I know you had in mind the council's first priority, which is more ongoing funding so we can open courtrooms and hire back commissioners and hire back court reporters, and pushed hard for that as well. But this is a tremendous change and improvement from the time that she took over, so thank you, Mike.
Yeah, thank you, Judge Cool.
Any other comments, questions, concerns? That's why Martin's here. I'll echo the same comments. I also appreciate the transparency that I think you tried to at least emphasize to let everybody know. I mean, I was, for instance, when you were on the phone call and you commented about this, the 2.5 or the COLA that's going statewide, I think it was appropriate to let everybody know the details as far down as they can get. So our mission is to share those details and work through those details rather than any other way. So any other questions, comments, any thoughts about, I know the message was sort of one-time funding on a lot of these aspects. I think Zlatko's going to address some of that as well. But I think we're moving more towards the direction of one-time and ongoing for a lot of things.
Yeah, in all candor, I think, you know, one time is certainly being used, but it's not bold to say that I think we intend to fully advocate and demonstrate that one-time funding ought to become continuous funding. But I think the table's been set a little bit about of, well, can you prove it? Can you show it? I think it was huge that the administration started to articulate, at least in their proposal, some examples of the innovations and the things that are going on. I think there's now a recognition that the courts have responded to the cuts and the reductions and responded in a way that is just very positive and that reforms have actually occurred. And they've occurred in the name of creating more access to court services for the public. And that at least was one of the big themes in there that I think was striking. It's one of the things that we wanted to see. It's one of the things, candidly, that is the benefit of me being able to get out to some of the courts. And I'm very, now in retrospect, pleased that the Chief Justice was pushing me out into the trial courts to get a better understanding of it. And I have visited many, many of your courts. And I said this on the call, and I can't overemphasize how valuable it is to have actually seen now what is going on in the court, so that when you're having discussions about the budget and trying to advocate for the budget, it isn't just a discussion of numbers and technical aspects. It's actually being able to illustrate some of the things that are going on in the courts throughout the system. I must have been able to share at least 20 to 30 items with the administration of the changes that were going out there. They selected a few to actually put down in writing on paper, but that was just a select few. The things that are going on in Orange County, the things that are going on in Los Angeles Superior Court, it's just everywhere that I've gone in terms of a visit, there is something going on. And even with courts that have really been struggling because they're neither on a positive side of the Waffen formula or, you know, necessarily on the negative, they're sitting in the middle of trying to figure out things that are due, and even that was called out. And examples like that are Contra Costa Court, for example, Fresno, and the like. And so maybe there are opportunities here to keep adjusting that. It was a bit of a challenge, and so I just want to at least make sure that folks recognize, you know, where we are, if I put it in the context of this overall state budget and the branch budget. We are essentially funded this year, if it comes through the way it is. We will be funded at close to what we describe as our pre-recession levels in 2008. Now, certainly costs have increased in other areas of our operation, but part of the perspective of the administration is that we are actually funded at where we were at pre-recession levels. They actually describe it as they fund us at 10.5% in their view. And again, this is just how you view a particular budget. They take that view because they add in a lot of our facility dollars in that. And just to be real candid and not to over quibble with that worldview, our worldview tends to be that, no, we don't include facility dollars as a total amount of the state budget. And so I think it is more apt to describe, and it's a professional disagreement, it's more apt to describe it as closer to the pre-recession levels than actually 10 or 10.5% above what the pre-recession levels are. So that is important for folks to know because, again, this is the administration and how they propose. That is their worldview. They put it in the description before they present their budget. And, you know, again, the legislature will also have a worldview of how it is that we're funded, and then we have our own. And so we'll proceed to go through the next steps. The legislature will no doubt start to begin its hearing process related to that. We still have a lot of work to do. And so there is unfinished business. So for all of the good elements that are in there, we still have to grapple with the 1% reserve policy, for example. We still have to grapple with the fact that we are implementing the amnesty program, and there may be, in fact, extra costs that are in there that are funded. Rick Feldstein has done a very good job with me, at least, of making sure that I never forget that there might be an amnesty gap. And if the administration continues with its posture that it will backfill us for costs or things we can't control, then that's the kind of thing that during the coming year we're going to want to continue to make sure that we're cataloging what our true costs and actual costs and expenses to implement the program are. There's still also work to do on Prop 47 to continue to, again, catalog what is going on there in terms of workload. There was the language associated with judgeships, which is an issue that is, you know, high focus and of high interest for us. We're trying to find out a little bit more detail about what that means. That's something that, you know, this committee, as well as other committees like the PJ committee, the CEO committee, we're going to have a lot of conversations about that, I think, in the coming months and weeks on that particular subject. I know there are some meetings scheduled at the end of this month and in the early part of February, and those will become opportunities to start to talk about what that means. In the interim, our staff here, your staff here, we will do our best to figure out more and more details to inform those kinds of discussions and conversations, you know, along the way. And then, of course, there is new money for language access. We have to have discussions about that. We did not receive any funding for dependency counsel. That's an issue that's important to us. We are already doing committee work associated with that. I think a lot of that work, and I know Sherry Carter is part of that particular committee, is preparing to answer questions that are probably along the lines of how did it go with the $11 million? And making the case for the additional investment of the $22 million that remains, at which I think our priority number three as we sent budget proposals across. So I appreciate the kind words and the support from the members of the committee. that this is viewed as a positive. Again, I would stress that this is kind of a collective effort of everybody, putting together the information and working together to be able to do this. Similarly, it would be the collective effort in terms of how we advocate for it. But we do have additional work to do. We will always have additional work to do. And I at least wanted to, before I leave, share a short list and leave the committee with the impression that we know there is more to do here, but we do accept that at least that this is progress, but we can always do better. So thank you.
Any other?
Martin, am I reading this correctly, that if you look at what happened recently and now, is it the case that the trial court employees are the only state employees who have not been given a 2.5% increase?
No, I think the answer is that it varies throughout the state. You know, the general, as I understand it, the posture of the administration and maybe even the legislature as they have been approving these budgets over the last 2 years, especially the last 2 years with the 5% augmentation to trial court base operations, that there was discretion because that was discretionary money that courts were free to provide COLAs with that discretionary dollars if they were able to. The true story for us, unfortunately, is because there is still variation in funding and where courts are in terms of their solvency or their liquidity, however we want to describe it, it still is a persistent challenge for some courts, but it's less of a challenge for some other courts. And so given that, the administration takes a step back and says that that's what that was for, and for some courts that can solve it, great. Some courts, unfortunately, and we need to continue to work on that because the story is not the same, all throughout the system. But they have obviously separated the state level folks that the Supreme Court, the Courts of Appeal, the Habeas Resource Center, and even the Judicial Council staff, as these are state employees, and they put us on the schedule by which all other state employees were receiving it, albeit about we're trailing, I think, by a year of the formula that they set in motion with the other state employees. So that's my best way that I can articulate what their view has been on it. But I don't think it's fair to say all trial court employees have gone without COLAs in the period of time. Some have been able to, and regrettably some have not been able to.
Mr. Sherman?
The shifting of judges, the five judges, were there discussions about that with the Department of Finance, or did that just come at us out of the blue when the budget hit? And the second question, is there any buzz in the legislature about that, or any buzz in the legislature about modifying downward fines and fees, such as the administrative fee, et cetera?
Yeah, the best information, the best assessment that I can give you all is the issue, we've known it's been in CRIS focus for us for quite some time. And the issue, we were able to get it in CRIS focus in the legislature. And what happened is Senator Roth carried a bill last year, and to his credit, actually got it through the entire legislature and had it on the governor's desk. The governor vetoed that bill. But that bill was seeking appropriation for, was it 12?
Yeah.
12 new judgeships. I know that it was 10, 12 moving around, landed on 12, and he vetoed it. But in doing so, it brought that issue into focus. And they put a veto message in there where, they were recognizing the acute need in some of the courts, for example, San Bernardino, Riverside, and the like, and had recognized that. And then suggested that they might want to be considering or working with the council and the state judiciary on, well, this particular problem and how do you go about it. So I'm saying all to say we suspected that there was going to be something on there. And then, yeah, late in the process, I was informed that they were going to say something about judgeships and the allocation. I didn't know that it was going to be picking a number of five. And frankly, I'm still not sure why that number, but we're trying to find that out and figure that out. But then it suggests it's creating some statutory authority to be able to start to move them and work with us to develop. And that's what we'll do going forward, which is why I take a little time to say on that unfinished category, certainly that's one for us. And I would encourage this committee as well as the other committees of the council to start to grapple with, well, how would we go about doing something like that? And would that be helpful, or do we want to do we want to weigh in on altering or changing it or anything of the like?
Sorry, I know you have a meeting to get to, so I'm going to take one from Rick Feldstein and then Rick.
Okay, I'll be brief. In terms of the $30 million, which I think is very an exciting prospect, if you need any assistance from the courts in terms of identifying some specific ways that that money could possibly be used, without getting into an actual allocation process at this point, but just ideas that could create some excitement amongst the legislature and the executive branch. We already have groups that are already looking at those sorts of things, whether that be the CTCC, the Tyler User Group, or a subgroup of CAT. We're certainly there and willing to help you in that respect.
No, and I agree, and I thank you for that. And we do need to harness this as quickly as possible. If I were to make a recommendation to everybody, I would suggest that we start to get our arms around that as quickly as possible and start to harvest and pull out ideas and put, you know, cost figures associated with what we could do that we might scale. And people should start think right about what they want to try and do, because I think the faster we get engaged and involved in that and the faster we move, the better off that we're going to be. And I get that there will be some risk associated with that with different courts. But the faster we go, I think it's an opportunity to say that, you know, this is how we can continue to grow and improve our operations. And why can't, and I don't want to get too excited, but why can't 30 be more than 30? Why can't it be continuous? Why can't, and it just seems to me that it is an opportunity to open up and change the discussion about how you invest back into the branch. So.
And I you'll see the agenda this afternoon is quite wide open, and that's one of the things I think we should talk about is how we can participate in that. Martin reached out right away and said, you know what, there's a lot of voices to be heard here, and recognizing our voice is as well one that we want to make sure is heard. The quicker we respond to that, I think, the more critical we show the need is. So I appreciate that. Thank you very much for your comments.
Thank you, members.
Zlatko, for details.
Yeah. Thank you, Judge.
Oh, and I just want to say that Mike Plant has joined us. He's here, and now there's only three empty seats next to me. So
I know we're coming up against our time a lot.
Don't worry about it.
We will go into whatever level of detail is needed. I did want to address maybe, so I'm not redundant of everything that was said last week, so we can bring it fresh. I want to just describe some of what has happened since the budget came out. We did have an extensive meeting with the legislative analyst office on Monday. They had on Sunday night had sent us questions of 6 pages worth of questions on the budget, and so we tried to respond to those, and staff are in the middle of preparing responses, but they are involved with respect to the innovations program, asking about the trailer bill coming for the judgeships, the peremptory challenges. They're very interested in the language access plan and the and our path forward in terms of implementation of that, and as it relates to the current year surpluses that we still carry. They asked about Prop 47 quite a bit, and their interest as the legislative analyst is not just on our specific budget area, but also understanding what it means in terms of our savings. And in the budget, there was the Department of Finance is required per the initiative with respect to Prop 47 to identify a savings amount that is transferred into a safe neighborhoods fund. They did identify a savings amount, a small amount, I believe around $4 million that we provided to them. But they did not take that money from our budget. And the LAO was interested in the estimate and the rationale for why no resources were pulled from the branch. And the explanation is that we're not while we are caseload, workload-based, we are not funded in that manner. And so even though maybe workload is changing, it's still premature to understand the ultimate impacts. But that it's not a time to take resources from the branch, given that we are underfunded for our workload. Ask about benefits. They have these annual questions, but they want to understand the cost changes as it relates to the trial court employee benefits. They have extensive questions about our fines and fee revenues into the TCTF. They are aware, and we've done, I think, a good job of explaining to them over the years the sort of fiscal status, the revenue status of the IMF and TCTF. And so that's them continuing their support for us and our revenue backfills. We spent quite a bit of time also on facility requests, spent some time on the information security BCP. And what this speaks to is that they have a short time to get an analysis out. So they need to be able to prepare responses to all of the budget change proposals that are in the governor's budget and prepare those for the subcommittee hearings that are coming up. And at the end of this month, there'll be an overview that they'll have to provide. And so each policy area staff is looking at their areas. And we benefit from the fact that Anita Lee, who maybe many of you have met or heard of, has come and done court visits, is fairly knowledgeable about our branch. And I think as far as Department of Finance staff and LAL staff, she would be the most senior in terms of tenure in her position, and she's done a good job, I think, of getting out there. So she understands a lot of the nuances, and then therefore she asks some questions that maybe others might not, because she gets deeper into the understanding of things. And so, but we enjoy that because we think the more that she understands it, the more that she can appreciate the challenges that the branch is facing. So but that's part of what we do in terms of our process here in the spring, is working with the LAO to make sure that they, if there's any concerns that they have, that we really do address them and get them so that their annual analysis and their presentations before the legislature are positive. Not to say that they won't have their overall policy issues and they may not necessarily agree with everything we do, but to the extent that we can minimize and put off and push off the table any of the issues that they have, you know, that's our goal in representing you. The most recent discussions we have with the Department of Finance, they've come to us in response to our questions about sort of more detail in the budget. And one issue that we spent some time on is the $10 million and how that works. The one-time funding for a replacement of the 2% process. I think I said on the calls that we have a monthly meeting with the Department of Finance, and we have, part of our agenda is the same every time. We always talk about the implications of the 1%. We talk about the 2%. We talk about, you know, new issues, but we explain to them the problems with the 2% and the delays in the money coming back and what it causes in terms of budget planning and cash management for you. And so we were pleased when they presented this to us in the budget, but we then asked, well, what does that mean with the existing statute? And so their interest is in eliminating the existing statute and merely requiring the council to develop a process to maintain the 10%, the $10 million, which I think was something that I know Sherry in previous discussions had funded, and then we can work on keeping it replenished as we allocate it. And so I'm very pleased that, you know, we would pass those issues on. It just is an evidence to that we don't just sit on these issues, but we do take forward your comments and concerns and your ideas for them to hear. So we're very glad about that, and they're going to leave it to us to develop the process as opposed to the process that they had established for the 2% in terms of the October 1st and the October 31st timelines and the distributions of the money. So we're looking forward to that. They did discuss sort of the broad concepts of the judgeships in terms of questions to us. They don't have a trailer bill language developed yet, but they asked us about the most recent judicial needs assessment. And where would the, based on the most recent report, where would these five judges go? We said we would get back to them on that. But they don't have a specific court where they'd like to put them. They want us to provide them information. They all also want to know what the most recent vacancies are in terms of the judges. And that's important because where judicial needs are doesn't mean that's where vacancies are. And so you have to reconcile. And we wouldn't want to have them going down a path of taking vacancies where there are still needs, and so that's an issue that they're grappling with. They, I think in their message, they talk about reallocation of resources and staffing and security, and in the back of the budget, there's an amount of $700,000 that they've allocated to supplement security funding at the courts that would receive the five, and so we asked them, where does this five come from, and they just said it's just a number. They didn't indicate that it was. They know that our need is well beyond that, and so I think from their perspective, five was just a number to put out there that has some merit, but not. It's not. It doesn't cause too much disruption from their perspective. So, but we are looking forward to working with them, and we were pleased to see that the security issue is addressed. We asked them about whether they thought that staff resources would be reallocated, and we explained to them that where the judicial needs is greatest is where WAFM is aligned, and so there's resources moving there, and those where they're viewed as overages in your judicial needs are tend to be those courts that are also losing resources. So to then have WAFM do its work and then have a taking of the resources that go along with the judgeship, move them would seem to be an issue. But it was something that we definitely need to talk about as a group to make sure that we're representing that to the Department of Finances, what would be our perspective on any resource reallocations beyond just the judgeships. They did want to learn a little bit more about the peremptory challenges, and so we're giving them a lot of data from the legislation that unfortunately failed this last go-around. So that's been the neural spacing discussions, and so I think, again, part of our job is to represent you and you know, push for more. We're going to be submitting the V3 BCP. The Department of Finance just came out with their timeline for their spring budget change proposals, and they're due February 10th. So we are well on our way to getting that to them. I know there's been a lot of work with the courts and the JCTC and staff, and so we're looking forward to presenting that. So there are opportunities, so we're still, you know, interested in pushing for those additional resources in the budget and places where there's been, you know, areas that have not been funded. As Martin has said, we continue our advocacy, not just with the legislature, but continued with the Department of Finance and the Governor's Office, because if you can't get the Department of Finance and the Governor's Office to support something that the legislature puts in, then it's likely that it won't make it in the final budget. We've had, optimism as we go through the spring process as the legislature's put in more money, but we've seen that hasn't come to fruition, only in a couple of occasions where the administration saw fit to agree with the legislature in terms of funding beyond their January proposal. So I don't know, do you want me to go through the details? Do you have questions? In terms of ongoing money, in the memo we talk about $90 million for the trial courts. About $60 million of that is ongoing, and only $30 million of that is one time. And I would say that the one times would be the Prop 47 money and the $10 million pot for the emergencies. But otherwise, when you talk about benefits, you talk about the judicial compensation, the revenue backfill, language access, the court operations. We talk about one time because I think we have a few new one-time items, but there's a decent amount of money that is ongoing from our perspective.
And that would include, so the funding for the Phoenix Financial would be not ongoing. That would be ongoing,
yeah,
rather than just a one-time.
Yeah, and that was characterized sort of separately. I mean, though it does have an absolute impact on the programs and services provided to the trial courts, it was an augmentation to the Judicial Council budget in terms of a general fund increase that, for therefore, it relieves expenditures from the IMF and gives us some ability to manage that fund, not in a, you know, in a cut way, but in a, hopefully in a sort of more long-term perspective, a way to use those resources for new and innovation. Would you like me to go through the details? I don't know if Stephen.
Of us were probably on the two or three phone calls from last week, and the memo is pretty detailed. So if anybody wants details and wants to ask questions about that, that's great. I know David wanted. David?
Before I ask questions, I think I'd really, Stephen, think that a couple of things I wanted to point out is that, so the Budget Advisory Committee had worked on improving a special display that outlines trial court, state trial court funding expenditures, and it's been something that was raised in the audit that was released last year. I think we did a good job of bringing sort of greater clarity. I know we put out many reports each year that contain this information in one report or another, but if you look in the budget display and you get to see the entirety of state trial court funding, and you can see what goes as trial court direct allocations and what are sort of indirect expenditures on behalf of the trial courts and managed by the Judicial Council or on behalf of. And I think that really gives people a sense as where's all the money going, all in 1.5 pages. We couldn't quite get it on one page, but I think it was a great improvement. And also in terms of the Judicial Council budget as response to the audit, and I think just an overall effort to improve transparency, there is now a breakdown of all the Judicial Council expenditures by fund, by office, by position, so that people can see a level of detail that the trial courts show in terms of positions and dollars, as well as their Schedule 1s, but what we show as a council, so if people can feel confident that we are showing everything that the council spends in support of the branch. Stephen has run, and I know this is typical when we get this time of year, what does the $20 million, if it were to be allocated as it's been under the WAFM, I think Colin has handouts we'll post it on our website for folks, is just a, as we say, a hypothetical, assuming that the 20 was done via WAFM based on the current caseload, the current factors that go into WAFM. But again, this is just as a conceptual planning. This is about the ballpark that these numbers would be again if they went out this way, and that's what we've done in the last couple of years when there's been new money and per the sort of definitions that this committee has worked on and what has taken to the council, how those new monies are allocated. And so I think we can turn it over to questions now.
David, did you have a question?
Thank you, Judge, and thank you very much, Lapka, for the details behind some of the information that we received last week. And I know that between now and May, there's going to be a lot of activity, certainly meetings that will be taking place in Sacramento to perhaps increase some of the numbers that the governor proposed. But I think back at a couple of years ago when we used the analogy of treading water, and that treading water number was about $260 million just to tread water. And, you know, the last couple of years, we received 90, we received another 90. You throw on top of that $20 million, we're still far short of that $260 million figure that we were turning to. I wonder if there's still capacity to suggest that $20 million needs to be perhaps a bit higher. We have courts that are still closing, courts that have not been able to reopen. I just, you know, bring this up to see if there's any opportunity for us to have further discussions in that regard.
Oh, and I think that's exactly what Martin has referred to in terms of there's still a gap between our priorities and what was identified in the governor's budget. And so, no, the advocacy for our branch priorities will continue. Definitely. So yes, that is. We're not stopping. I mean, we appreciate the governor's proposal, but yes, there's still a gap between what we saw as a council and as a branch in terms of needs and priorities, and that will continue.
And the numbers that you just handed out here, there are a lot of numbers on the far right column that don't have parentheses around them. They're additions, and there are many courts that have parentheses around them, which means it's a reduction. So a bit of distance that I'm hoping we can, you know, travel to reduce the number of parentheses going forward.
Indeed.
Thanks, Judge.
Chris, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Two things. So you mentioned the advocacy cycle. I think I want to acknowledge and make sure that I personally, on behalf of all of us, thank you for the advocacy that you guys did do. I did hear in the budget message what we've been saying and everything we've been saying. That 2% was a huge thing, the benefit, the comments. I mean, I felt like a lot of it was from our mouth, too, and so you're doing a great job. The Phoenix 7%, so I really did notice it this year, so thank you. Second thing is that although that judge thing, the five judges moving, came out of left field, it was a coincidence that day from another state I was copied on an email where they picked up a seat and moved it from one county to another, and they were explaining how they did it. So my advice on that is there are a lot of states in this country that do have procedures based on weighted caseload. It was a weighted caseload thing exactly like they're talking about, and they have their procedures built in. It went up to the Supreme Court for the seat to change, and they had a hearing and da-da-da-da-da and all of that. So there are states that you can draw on for that experience, and as I said, that coincidence was kind of strange that I was copied that day right when the budget message came out. So there are resources for us to look at.
Sure.
No. So good job. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
So it's an ongoing discussion. Judge?
I have a question. Prop 47 says that they'll apply savings to mental health, drug treatment programs, get K-12 schools, and crime victims. Whether it's in our budget or not, did they put that anywhere to get monies to counties to provide services for those in that? Have they... created a format to capture the
there
what
is
they
a fund, and I don't have the details, but I know what they have to show. They made an estimate of what would be the amount that would be transferred in into this Safe Neighborhoods Fund. And then I believe it's the Board of State and Community Corrections, I think, that facilitates its administration. And there are stated allocations of those resources to victims and whatnot. But so there is a global savings amount that's been set aside. And the Department of Finance and the Director of Finance has by August to finalize those. And it's their final determination as to what that amount is. And it's a savings against what your 13-14 baseline operations would be. And clearly, the vast majority of the savings are coming from prison savings, reduced populations in our state prison systems.
And so those should be flowing to counties to provide support in our courts? Is that theoretically what's supposed to be happening?
You know, I don't know enough about how that could work. We could definitely, working with Shelley Curran and her office, look into how the branch might participate in the expenditure. Then on the other side, as far as working with our community partners on new and innovative programs.
Yeah, just anecdotally, you know, we just are now seeing those same people over and over and over again, being on misdemeanor probation, getting no real services, and just sort of coming back again and again. And so to be able to have access to some monies that could get them some support and structure might be beneficial, and I think that's the only way to really foresee the true benefit of what they tried to do with Prop 47, yeah, besides clear out the jail, the prison.
I'll make sure staff note that. We'll circle back with Shelley and her staff to see what they know about that and how we can leverage. I mean, obviously, we've been very involved in the Recidivism Reduction Fund and the grants, that the monies that we were given, the $15 million and then $3 million the last couple of years. So folks see us as a partner in the overall continuum on a positive note, and so hopefully we can then sort of continue that that positivity there with us.
Might be an example of where there's an overlap between that and the innovations grant money. I mean, things we can come
fair
forward
point,
with suggestions for that. So I'm sorry, go ahead, Jose.
Just a caution that while we also recognize the gap of wraparound services by the shift of Prop 47, we should not assume that responsibility that historically was in other, you know, justice partners. Just because they are not providing those services, we also should not jump in to fix it without first making sure that that level of funding is provided. Otherwise, you know, the court would be expected to provide those services that are now not being provided by probation or other services.
I just want to echo that comment. It is a county responsibility to provide the services. I don't think that the branch should try to solve that problem. Just like security under realignment became a county responsibility.
Yeah, I think there's a difference between solving and participating. You're right. I don't think we should solve the problem. Go ahead.
And I wasn't suggesting to solve it. I just think we need to be in the discussions, because if we aren't in the discussions, then it takes a whole different dialogue, and that doesn't benefit the people we're trying to get off their streets and make their neighborhoods safe.
All right.
Yeah, just along that line, too, I kind of look at the CCP effort and the funding, the realignment funding that came our way, and the bulk of that went to the counties to distribute. And I found myself at some meetings that, yeah, we'd love to participate in this kind of program, but I don't have the funding for, you know, a staff, an analyst or some, you know. And so it would be nice if there would be a way that we could, you know, be included in the dollars in some fashion. But just a suggestion.
Judge?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question and a comment. The question is, in terms of the reserve fund, how does the $10 million compare to how much the 2% has produced in the past?
Well, the 2% was far more than was ever historically set aside from the improvement fund. Historically, there was a calculation that within the improvement fund, there needed to be a set aside of funds. It was a percentage, and that ranged from 9 to $13 million. When the improvement and modernization funds were merged and that reserve process was eliminated, in the 2012 budget. If you recall, that was when the administration proposed to eliminate fund balances and have them be zero. Their original proposal was zero fund balances at the trial court level and 3% at the state level. Well, ultimately, in however it got negotiated, it became 2% set aside to be returned and 1% to remain at the trial court level. So though they called it an emergency fund, it didn't quite equate to the dollar value that the improvement fund used to set aside. So now it was $37 million is what that 2% was. And we have been giving out, I mean, it's requests and approved requests have been, you know, fractions of, you know, several hundred thousand dollars, a couple million dollars. We've barely used that. And that's been part of the problem is that the massive amount of money that's been held back, then returned with uncertainty based on the number of requests that would come in is what I think, you know, we did a good job of indicating to the Department of Finance. So their $10 million is in line with what that historical set aside was from the improvement fund for those needs. And so the idea I think that they have is if we allocate $1 million, then next year's allocations will take $1 million to replenish that. So it's only on the fractions, but it's taken so that it can keep that fund whole. It's a kind of a long answer, but that's, I wanted to give you a little context as to how we got there and why they got down to 10. Because it's much closer to what was the historical amount.
Okay.
It's still far above of what we've gotten requests for over the past 3 years.
So it's essentially a one-time funding of 10, and then as we drain the bathtub after that, we fill it back up again.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Thank you. Judge,
go ahead. Comment.
The governor's proposal on the 5 judgeships in the budget is consistent with his veto message of Senate Bill 229. I think we got kind of a forecast of the governor's
Indeed.
Position in that veto message, and really this budget message is consistent with that.
Mm-hmm. And just in case anybody's wondering, we're great on the schedule because the next item's not going to take 40 minutes, it's going to take about 10 minutes. So questions any more at all? But we have Zlatko here. Judge?
Along the lines of what David was saying, in looking at what was just handed out, and I think this is probably consistent, 5 of the 10 largest counties are seeing reductions. Have we calculated the number of trial court employees, plus or minus, who have had some kind of a cost of living increase versus who haven't? Because I think there's a real equity issue here, where every employee in the state is getting 2.5% or has gotten 2.5%. And a lot of our employees have gotten nothing for many, many, many years. And if the argument is, well, it was in the 5% plus the 5%, the answer is no, it wasn't. And I think we ought to try to figure out in specifically how few employees or how many employees did see an increase, because our employees are the only state employees, as near as I can reckon, who have not consistently been treated the same as every other state employee. And I just see that as a significant equity issue.
And I think I don't believe we have that information readily available and reported to us. So we'd have to, I believe we'd have to work with the PJ Advisories and the SEAC to gather that information as part of the advocacy message. So I would look then to you all to give us that information and outline, you know, what that means. You'd have to reveal what it is that you have, truckers have added, so that we have this. Not everybody's been treated in the same fashion.
Yeah, I think, and that's something I'd like to discuss this afternoon as well, is the $20 million. Is it, I mean, there is the perspective or view that goes out pursuant to WAFM, because that, and Judge, I've had some conversations with Judge Earl about this. You know, that was WAFM. I mean, that's what we said up front is sort of here's where we're going. It might be painful in the past, and it might be painful in the future. But I understand, and too, the inequities that result if we follow march down that path. So I'd like to continue that discussion. Sherry?
So I'm just going to say that when you use the word the inequities that follow from
I'm just saying
WAFM,
what Judge Good talked about inequities.
I know, but the inequities have been addressed because of WAFM, because it's based on workload. And my only comment about the salary is that you're right, it is a hard one to get your arms around because, for example, in L.A., they haven't had raises since 07 in their base, or 07 for non-rep and 08 for rep, represented employees. So, but it's really kind of a snapshot in an overall picture, and it's really hard to get your arms around. So I think it would be really difficult. Maybe we could talk when we have a lunch break about any ideas.
I don't mean to suggest that WAFM is creating inequities. I think the state budget is creating the inequities when it used to be pre-recession.
Yes.
That our employees got the same raises as everybody else, and that money was put in our budget without asking. It was just simply an accepted proposition. And now we've been the only, certainly, branch, and that's been cut out from that.
Good point. I'm sorry, go ahead, Rebecca.
Just a comment. My recollection is that when we got the 5% and then the 5%, that we were encouraged to talk about the changes we made in terms of public access, not in terms of our employees. And so I believe that was documented a number of times, and so that perhaps should be revisited with them as well.
That we've made significant strides in that regard. Rick?
And if we are going to collect and put out this kind of information, I think we need to balance it, too, with some of the takeaways that went along with those increases, whether that be increased payment for retirement, benefits, current furlough hours that
layoffs.
Are still being experienced, layoffs, et cetera.
I think, as Sherry said, it's a multifaceted discussion.
No doubt.
Any other questions for Zlatko? Again, I'll echo the same thing. And, I mean, personally, you've been of great assistance, and thank you for helping us understand what on the face is sometimes simplistic, and as we drill down, is anything but.
Yeah, a couple of more things as I'm recalling and looking at my notes. Something that, like, for example, the 1%, we talk about it, but, you know, there's a bill that's being pursued by, I think, a member from San Bernardino about increasing the 1%. So those issues are still percolating. I mean, it's coming from a Republican member, and I don't know how successful they'll be. But, you know, we are appreciative of the fact that folks do hear, you know, our message, and it's not always the administration that we're relying upon. But we appreciate that a member will raise that, and that, therefore, it gives us an opportunity to discuss it. So it's not just us, but I think, you know, because you all, I'm sure, have your conversations with members and raise these issues as the same. And if we're all sort of, you know, similar tones, then I think it will resonate. And so that, I think that's good for us. And that's an example where we're seeing it. We're working on the legislative side. One more thing in terms of the $30 million. There are some sort of, I would call them, broad parameters in the budget bill. The actual bill, you know, that is the law of the budget related to the $30 million. And it echoes what was written in the budget summary itself. And so we're going to have staff excerpt that and provide that to everybody so that you can see sort of the a little bit more detail. I mean, it ultimately does say that it's a program developed and administered by the Judicial Council, but so there's still a lot to determine. But it talks about reporting, talks about kind of the parameters, again, like what were written in the message for you to see. So there's still a lot to work on, but the administration does have some of its vision there, and we'll share that with you, and we'll put it on the website so that everybody can also see that. And that's all that I have until
Anything
the next
else?
Time.
Any other questions at all at this time? Okay. Thank you very much for the update. I appreciate it, and the assistance in some complicated issues. The next item on the agenda, do we have Judge Smith? Are you on the phone? We may have to skip over that, but Judge Smith is going to join us. Mary Beth Todd, as all of you know, is in the midst of both a resignation and a new building, and so she was not able to participate in this item. But I did have a conversation with Judge Smith. She was going to present telephonically. She had an ankle injury, I think, that prevented her from being here. So we'll do our best. Maybe staff, somebody could get in touch with Judge Smith and see if she's going to join us. I know it's going to be a brief presentation.
I'm prepared to discuss
that. That'd be great.
But if we want to wait for Judge Smith, that's fine by me. And if she's not available, then I can make the presentation on the issue.
Okay, we'll wait a few minutes to see if we can get her available. Otherwise, I appreciate you filling in. So next, we'll skip to item 3 on the agenda. Judge Cope and Sherry, I'll kick that one to you. Recommendations of court-appointed counsel funding. This is on the agenda as an action item, but I'm going to move it to a discussion item. As we were developing the agenda and the materials, we had to be careful to keep it as an action item in case it was ready to go. But I think, as we're going to hear, it's more appropriately a discussion item today. So I'm designating it as a discussion item rather than action. Judge Cope?
It's also designated for 40 minutes, and I think we'll probably be home for lunch. But because I don't have that much to talk about, and if you have questions or discussion, of course, that's fantastic. But this is just the follow-up on the item that in April of last year, on April 17th of last year, the Judicial Council adopted a proposal that came from this committee, from the Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee, to essentially do with court-appointed dependency council funding what we've done with court funding altogether, and make the funding allocations caseload-based instead of historically based. The historical basis had led to a situation where we had some courts that were funded at about 30% of their identified need, and other courts that were funded in roughly 150% of their identified need. And so there was a vast disparity between or among the courts. And they also had at the same time the situation where attorneys appointed in dependency cases in one court would be paid $1,500 per case, and in another court, less in 20 courts, it was less than $500 per case. So there was an inequity that needed to be addressed, and the Judicial Council did address that, and that part's done. This committee proposed an allocation methodology that transitions over, I think Sherry and I were debating whether it's 3 years or 4 years, but I think in the fourth year it's 100% based on caseload. Sherry, is that right? Oh, I also should mention Don Will is the staff person who's been the lead on this, and is here to answer questions if there are any, too. And then Sherry's the brains behind the entire thing. So in year four, we're at 100%, right?
It's 4 years. We all get to 100%. Well, we get to the same level of whatever is funded.
Good point.
Yeah,
what I mean by 100% is we're 100% funded based on caseload and not on historical basis.
That's exactly right.
So at any rate, we should be in year two of that here soon.
Next fiscal year, yeah.
Right. And so as part of the adoption of that process, the Judicial Council created a joint subcommittee, a joint committee of the Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee and the Family and Juvenile Law Advisory Committee, and gave that subcommittee 8 tasks to perform, asked essentially 8 questions. The answers that the subcommittee is going to propose to the Judicial Council, we had a deadline to report back to them in April of this year, so that was a year and it's almost done. And the answers are in the report that you'll find in your materials. I think it's at page 41 of your, combined page 41 of your materials, and I know you've all read it, and so I won't go over all those with you again, but there are some modifications that were appropriate to make. And there has been a lot of work. There have been numerous meetings with each other and also numerous meetings with interested parties, the bar, the Dependency Council bar, with various courts. There have been surveys sent out. And that report is the result so far. And I think that's all I would have to say. Sherry, anything you want to add?
I'm just going to interrupt. I did want to acknowledge that we do have a public comment on this by letter form from the Bar Association of San Francisco. It's in your materials. It's our only public comment on item 3. But we do have it. It's in the materials. It's been considered. I'm sorry, Sherry. Go ahead.
No, that's fine.
That's right.
I think the report did a really good job in identifying the elements we were asked to look at with our joint working group and what the recommendations were. And there were some adjustments made, as you can see, to account for some of the concerns that were expressed both at the Judicial Council meeting and by the public, by the groups that came to the meetings. And I think these are really good adjustments, and look forward to Judge Cope presenting them to the council in April.
Am I? And then Judge Conklin, if it's all right, Don, is there anything you wanted to add?
No, sir.
Okay. Judge Coffman, did you have your hand up?
Yeah, I'm on page 43 and number 8, you talk about whether dependency council funding should be a court or county obligation, and you don't answer the question. In my historical perspective is that we didn't always do dependency council. It was a county function. And then about 8-10 years ago, it got switched to the courts. And there was a political reason for that. Also, as you stated, there was more continuity and more stability by the courts doing it. But now we're underfunded. Is there a discussion about putting it, if they're not going to fund us properly, is putting it back to the counties and let them do it? Or is that an option that we've discussed?
Sure.
So we did do quite a bit of legal-type research, and it is a state judicial branch responsibility.
It's by legislature passive. We didn't always do it.
Yes, when the state trial court went into effect, dependency council funding was listed as a court operations account. So you're right, it could be changed, but it was listed in numerous places. And, Don, you can give details.
But we had that discussion about why
we did.
Whether we should do that or not.
We did.
Yes, really beginning in the prior committee that looked at the four-year reallocation, and then it over a number of conference calls, the subcommittee reviewed the statutes. They reviewed the history of how, as Sherry said, it came over as a judicial branch allocation when trial court funding began. And this was certainly the sense of the subcommittee, that they were ready to leave it there, I think. Leave it as a judicial branch function for the purposes of the report and the recommendations.
But we probably should clarify that for the report that goes to the council.
Yes.
To make sure it's clearly identified that
Yes.
it was discussed numerous times, and there was a lot of legal research provided over probably 3 or 4 meetings.
And there were a number of reasons. The general sense was, you know, this is really beyond the scope of what a subcommittee of a committee of a council is really here to do. That's a political decision or political call that somebody else is going to have to deal with.
The answer should be a little more explicit explaining that. Right. Number 8.
It's a legislative fix. It's not our fix.
Well, Judge Conklin, this is Glenda Saunders. May I make a comment or two about the recommendations concerning Dependency Council?
Of course.
Firstly, I apologize for not being there, but I have not an ankle injury, but an eye injury. I look as if I've been the subject of domestic battery, which is not the case. So forgive me for not being there in person. 2 comments. I know how much work has gone into these recommendations, and I know that one is constrained by the amount of money we can expect. But I wondered why, with regard to recommendation 1, the attorney salaries used in the workload model estimates are recommended to be based upon the median salary for the first tier range for county council in all counties, given that, at least in Orange County and I think in other counties, most dependency council have years and years of experience. I would say in Orange County they have upwards of 15 years experience. And so we're vastly underestimating the costs of dependency council if you base it upon that parameter. I assume there was discussion of this, and I wondered if you could elucidate us as to why that recommendation is being made.
That's best for Don.
Sure. That was probably the piece of the recommendations that did elicit the most discussion at the subcommittee, and there are a couple of reasons why right now the subcommittee came to the recommendation or is coming to the recommendation that it would be based on the first tier. In the first place, which might not be that evident, although it's in the subcommittee materials, the counties are not really consistent with their tiers of county council, whether it's the first, which would be entry through intermediate, and the second, which would be intermediate through advanced. So the information available to us was not always very consistent. Some counties don't have a tier structure like that. Some do. The nomenclature for county council was also not particularly consistent: assistant, associate, deputy, county council. So the committee decided, the subcommittee decided to go with the best information it had at the moment, which would be what we could establish as the first tier in most counties and using the midpoint there. I think at the same time they expressed that they would like to have more information, basically data from all of the counties that would really pinpoint what their comparative salary is to the, so to speak, typical dependency council attorney who is, as you say, might have several years of experience. So with our time constraints, we weren't able to get to that. We went out as staff and began work on it, but it's going to be something of a lengthy process after we talked to several counties and heard what they would need from us and then what it would take them to give us that information. So I think then the subcommittee has decided to go with probably the best and closest match that after reviewing a lot of data they felt they had right now, which was the midpoint of this range of what is really beginning entry level through kind of first level intermediate county council.
Is this still a work in process then, or are we being asked to, not today because I realize we've turned it into a discussion item, are we going to be asked to recommend that we use the first tier range? I believe you had four classes, classes one and two and classes three and four, and you're recommending median salary for class one or for classes one and two?
This is the midpoint of what we called classes one and two, yeah.
Okay, and why would we not rather seek, place the bar a little higher and seek the median of classes one, two, three, and four? I mean, given the reality that it seems most people who do dependency work have developed expertise in the area, they just aren't entry-level attorneys typically. I would be concerned about recommending this because we seem to be placing the bar so low.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my comment, my issue. I understand you've all done a great deal of background research, but I would have some concern about voting in favor of that recommendation. The second issue, John, is the GPSS data versus the DCCS data. The GPSS data on the number of filings per year undercounts the number of clients being served, and I'm sure you're aware of that, because dependency cases tend to last multiple years beyond the initial filing, and certainly the complexity, the litigation, and the continued involvement in the case is not captured by simply the filing number. So while the GPSS data tells us how many new clients per year we get, it doesn't reflect ongoing clients, in particular the post-permanency cases and the non-minor dependents. Instead of weighting the metric by 30% filings and 70% child welfare caseload, did the committee consider a more conservative 10% GPSS, 90% child welfare caseload to ensure that attorneys are compensated for the number of actual clients being represented?
Yes, Judge, they did. As a matter of fact, this was probably the second most discussed topic in the recommendations, and staff presented several models that the subcommittee looked at. We looked at weighting at 10% GPSS, 90% child welfare data, at the 30% and 70%, and I believe at 50-50 and 100%. GPSS, because I'll mention to the subcommittee, which they might not remember, historically this model has used 100% as its caseload, the data from the California Department of Social Services, or the what we're calling the child welfare data. So they did look at a number of financial scenarios and at the weighting scenarios over time, and after a lot of discussion settled on the 70-30.
Judge, this is Sherry Carter. We did spend a lot of time on this in particular, and based on quite a bit of statistical analyses, felt that the 30% on gypsies was the best combination, because when a new case is filed, there is a lot more work with an initial filing than the ongoing cases. And so by using a higher percentage of the child welfare numbers, the courts that have new filings do not have the credit because of the larger amount of work when a case is filing. So there was a lot of probably several meetings dealing with this, and it was really looked at very carefully and felt that this was the best scenario. And the other thing to remember is that every court is treated the same, that when you're looking at the filings, it does make sure that the courts are treated the same when you're using the same kind of formula.
And I know Judge Smith called in. Judge Smith, we're going to go back to your item as soon as we're done here in about 5 minutes.
Okay, great. I'm sorry to call in. I was on the bench.
That's all right.
Sherry, I understand this is not a question I'm posing as a point of advocacy for Orange County, because I understand that all 58 counties are being treated the same way. It's a concern I have for all counties, that by weighting it so much, by giving a 30% weighting to gypsies, you may be overestimating the work involved in new cases versus the ongoing work in the older cases. But, I defer to the work that you obviously did in the subcommittee. It just it does personally concern me, not just from Orange County's perspective, but from all counties' perspective.
And I think it's a great example of as Judge Cope said, a subcommittee of a subcommittee really drilling down, doing some important and difficult work. And I think these are all very valid concerns. It appears they've been addressed. I don't think we ever come up with answers that please everybody, but I think the work of this committee has recognized the concerns of everybody, unless Judge Cope, you want to add anything further on that.
Can I just make a real brief comment? And that is that there, through this process, and even today with Judge Saunders' comments, there are really two distinct questions. One is, how big's the pie? How much is the allocation that's necessary to fully fund dependency counsel statewide? And that's what goes to really Judge Saunders' comments. My view of this subcommittee's work was that wasn't ignored, and in fact, sometimes it seemed like it was going to take over. But really, this subcommittee's job was to decide how to divide up whatever pie we ended up having. Whatever the legislature and the governor allocate for dependency counsel, how's that going to be divided up among 58 courts? And so I think Judge Saunders' questions and concerns are very fair, very legitimate, but they point out those two separate questions.
Agreed. Any further? So what is there? You talk about going to the council. Is there any further action? This is a discussion item today. Does this need to come back before us as an action item?
No, this is that subcommittee was to report to the council.
Okay, so it doesn't need to come to us for any further action. All right, thank you very much for your work on that. It's a difficult issue, as many of these are. Appreciate the time that was taken on that. We appreciate the public comment that was submitted and all the comments that were made to the subcommittee. Any additional issue or questions on this before we turn back to item two? Judge Smith has now joined us. By the way, I'm trying to keep an eye on the agenda and the timing. With Rebecca, our 15-minute item is going to be shorter than that, much shorter. So we're going to go back to item two, and then we're going to go. Stephen Nash has joined us. We're going to go to the item four, 10:58, in about 5 minutes. If anybody on the phone is obviously wants to hear about that too, that's our timing. That being said, Judge Smith, thank you so much. Turning back to item two, the update from the ad hoc working group on fiscal planning. Were you back with us, Judge Smith? You were. The best laid plans. All right, Judge Smith, if you're by chance talking, you're on.
Hello.
There you are.
This is Judge Smith. I'm sorry.
So we had a conference call yesterday, and Zlatko was going to be present to actually discuss this in person with everyone. I think
he's here.
He can bring everyone up to date on where we are. The ad hoc committee has been meeting over the last several months. Mary Beth Todd, unfortunately, who's retiring, has had to drop out of it, but she's done a lot of really hard work. And the subcommittee has talked at length about and has come up with a tentative structure for courts to save for capital projects and other major projects which can't be funded in a single fiscal year. I think the probably the more pressing issue, and one which I think Zlatko is prepared to talk about today, is are those counties who are currently developing case management systems, because they have an urgent need to deal with these issues right now and in this fiscal year. And our plan may be a little bit more long range in terms of getting it settled. So we thought we'd take a bifurcated approach, which was to sort of address the counties that have case management systems that need an additional sort of a boost or an immediate solution, and then a little bit more long-term solution of a structure for courts to save money for case management and also other large projects for which they cannot save in a single year. And David Yamasaki, I don't know if you're there, you are also on the call, and he is our new co-chair of the ad hoc committee to also talk about this.
I am, Judge, and I will be happy to make contributions.
I can't hear.
You were not, I don't think you were on, or you were hitting cough or something.
Judge, can you hear me?
Now I can.
Okay. Yeah, I'm here and I'm happy to contribute however I can.
All right. So maybe I can take away where we are and what we've done so far. Let me take you back a little bit in terms of what the status is and why we are where we're at. As part of reacting to the 1%, we did bring this issue of encumbrances to the Department of Finance in terms of an appropriate mechanism to manage expenditures as the year ends that state agencies have, in which they can, in which they have a contractual obligation that may not be able to be spent, actually paid by the end of the fiscal year. What do state agencies do? Well, they encumber these funds, they set them aside, so when the bill actually comes in for that, which was obligated during a particular fiscal year, they can then, as they say, liquidate those expenditures. And state agencies have 2 years to liquidate after they make an encumbrance of any particular year's appropriation. So we don't live in an appropriation world in the trial courts, but given the 1%, we effectively kind of back into a cap. And so that was an important process and of giving some additional fiscal flexibility to trial courts in managing this 1%. But coming out of that, there's been issues where, in particular with case management systems, and in the development of that encumbrance policy, we worked very closely with the Department of Finance. We gave them a legal opinion to start the ball rolling, and then all of our FAQs and guidelines regarding how encumbrances should be done were all worked with the Department of Finance and their fiscal systems consulting unit, so that we were lockstep with what it is that state agencies have. So now we get to the situation where funds have been encumbered and this two-year liquidation period is ending for this first year that the 1% comes into place June 30th. And we have case management systems that are being delayed. The implementation and the deliverables will come after the end of the liquidation period. What do we do? Well, state agencies, as I mentioned, having appropriations can come back to the Department of Finance and the legislature and get something called a reappropriation, where they take that what was unspent and they say, we need to spend it in another later fiscal year. But trial courts are not appropriated. You're allocated. Your funds are in your bank accounts. So it's not quite the same mechanism. And so what we thought was important was, as we're working on this process to allow, in this short term, these CMS needs to be able to be sort of carried forward, also working with the Department of Finance, because we don't want them to look like this is some circumvention of the 1%. And we have two new staff, as I mentioned earlier, in terms of LAO and DOF. We have two new staff who don't have that history from 3 years ago when we worked with them on the encumbrances. And so we have to get them to ensure that they don't see it as a reaction to some way to be overly creative. We think we're just doing that which is appropriate, because we would not want you to make payment, liquidate that encumbrance, and not actually receive the deliverable. We think that that's a bad business practice and easily defensible to the Department of Finance. But with that, I had a conversation with them about this narrow issue regarding case management systems, but also opening the door in the discussion about a process by which trial courts have an opportunity to save, and how could that be accomplished within the existing statutory framework with respect to 1% and the overages and it coming back to the trial court trust fund for allocation by the council. So spend some time reminding them of their boss's statements before the council when David and others were asking, why is the 1%, how does that work? And Michael Cohen sitting here saying that it's the reserves can exist, we want them to be existing at the state level and can be allocated for needs of the branch and the trial courts. And so we're taking them up on that offer of establishing a structure that would identify a parameters by which you can save for that new facility that's opening up, for that equipment replacement that you're not able to fund within your limited and insufficient budgets. So that's sort of the longer term. But the reactions have been from the Department of Finance is, well, how much are we talking about with the CMSs? And so talk to David, and I think that there's going to be some effort to try and gather some data. And they wanted to see the parameters under which we would do this. And so we have these draft parameters that we're going to want to share with them, just to give them a sense that this is a thorough, thoughtful, and transparent process that everybody's aware of, which is what we're sort of reinforcing with the Department of Finance. That's what you've asked for, and so we're doing that. And we're going to move. We want to move forward in providing appropriate and flexibility to the trial courts, no different than, again, a state agency. But since we aren't appropriated, then what is our method to use the tools we have from an accounting, budgetary, allocation process? And so I think we're heading in the right direction, but, you know, again, because of the turnover at the Department of Finance, it takes a little bit more work to educate them on the history so that they can feel comfortable with what it is that we're proposing, and that it is no different than what other agencies at the state level have available to them, and how we can mirror it in terms of a reappropriation concept. But it's a reallocation of those dollars for known and critical priorities of the trial courts and the council.
Very good. Jose? Oh, I'm sorry. Was there a question? David?
No. Do you know when we might have something that we can kind of put a stake on it? And the reason why I'm saying that is that some of us are right in the middle of, you know, the negotiations with not only
Indeed.
Our local justice partners, but also the contractor. And so we have certain deliverables, and obviously we want to liquidate that and not lose it. But at the same time, right now is the time to say, you know, we're not going to compromise to go live, you know, and defer certain things after go live. So a timeline as to when we might have that?
After we gather the information on terms of the scope of the dollars, I'd like to get that to the Department of Finance right away. And my hope is that the subcommittee, the ad hoc committee, can complete its work with respect to the CMS, get this, and hopefully as a phone meeting of the Budget Advisory Committee, so we can take something to the council in short order. I mean, I think we have February and March meetings of the council, so hopefully that we would be getting something, you know, no later than March, and if we can really get jamming on it, get it to the council in February. And that would hopefully give you enough time. But I think that the reason that we wanted to put this on the agenda today was to, for all those who are listening and those who are here that are in the middle of these, you know, these sort of tenuous moments of with the contractor and where we are and what kind of decisions you need to make to push something into the next fiscal year, that you're well aware of how far we are in the process and the plan.
So would your suggestion, we have a March 10 meeting, would your suggestion be we put this as an agenda item at that time but be willing to take it earlier on a phone call?
I would recommend that we get a phone meeting. I mean, the point of bringing this is that we're discussing it. So hopefully in the materials that we provide that we can have it, you know, move sooner than March.
Right.
But it'd be on a phone basis
for
a single item.
Okay. Any other questions for Slavik?
Unless there's concerns about that approach.
So this isn't just a one-time problem.
No.
This isn't just a problem now for the 27 or however many courts that are implementing case management systems now, because there's another 27 of us that aren't going to run into the same kind of issues. So
So I would hope that the solution would be something that would be ongoing.
So we're talking about two phases, a short-term CMS and then a long-term more broadly having those.
Yeah, if I can just speak to that. I was part of the committee when it was a subcommittee that was assembled, I think, in September. And we've met on several occasions and realizing the sensitivities that exist with the Department of Finance and the deadlines that we're all facing because this is the final year of that restriction on liquidation. We wanted to come up with one solution going forward. The immediate issue, of course, is making sure that the money doesn't evaporate before we take a delivery or we'll be able to obviously pay for our obligation. But at the on the other hand, with the elimination or the establishment of the 1% fund balance cap, it really doesn't give us any opportunity to save for major projects going forward. So we've assembled a structure to address both the immediate and the long term. Clearly, as Zlatko indicated, we needed to get a sense from the Department of Finance that the direction that we're moving is supported, and it seems to be supported conceptually. Now what we need to do is provide more details on how it is that we're going to be putting together the procedures, what's the mechanism for returning the money. We obviously are very concerned about their concern that we do not want to circumvent this restriction that was placed on us many years ago. But really, we need to build something so we can start planning for the future under these new guidelines. And I think this first step of getting information from the different courts of what we're facing with technology, case management systems, is the first issue. And I hope to get some information back from the court execs at next week's court execs advisory committee meeting so we can at least assemble examples that the Department of Finance is asking for.
One last thing, if I may. State agencies who have special funds that are able to, that at the end of the year, they don't spend all their appropriation. They can accumulate in their fund balance more than what we're restricted to. But they have to come back to the administration to ask for appropriation authority. So there's an absolute correlation between what we're talking about, in so much as say they save money, and they even tell the Department of Finance when the Department of Finance reviews fund condition statements and sees a growing fund balance, they would be then concerned, are say in a special fund for guide dogs for the blind, as an example, are their fees from their licensees too high? Well, no. If they have they know that they're about to invest in a new technology system, they have to tell the Department of Finance, we need to accumulate revenues into that fund so that we can come forward with a BCP to then spend that money. And I think that's where we've talked about trial courts don't get appropriations, they get allocations. And so we are again trying to do the same, because that same example exists where state agencies with special funds accumulate revenues in their fund balances, but then come and ask for the authority to expend it.
Judge Smith, did you want to add something?
I did want to add one thing, and that is that the ad hoc group has gone a long way to developing a structure for the long term. It's just that because this case management issue is imminent and the courts need some relief right now, it's sort of the first step in a way of sort of testing the waters. But we have gone a long way to establishing a structure that we can go to the council with and present for the longer term. So we started there, actually, and then we sort of stopped and kind of gotten on a little different path for obvious reasons. But I think hopefully within the next few months, we will have it all in place. And then it really just depends on politically how we should proceed and the safest way to proceed. But I think we are, as a group, and if anybody wants to weigh in on that, gotten a long way to devising what I think is a very clear system of sort of checks and balances that would allow us to present something reasonable to the Judicial Council that the Department of Finance would probably agree is okay.
All right, great. Judge Herman has a question, then I think we'll move from there to item four. Judge Herman?
Yeah, I just wanted to weigh in on this because I know it's a complete shock, but
in deploying case management systems. They sometimes are not deployed on the exact time frame that they should be, and kind of like the nuts and bolts of this is that it's progress payments to the vendor. So I just want to say I really appreciate the work that's being done on this. It is critical. The timing is critical. I mean, it's kind of hard to plan again with an April solution or a June 30 solution to this problem. But I think we that are in the crux of this difficulty are appreciative of the work that's being done on this.
Very good. And we will, as soon as it's appropriate, I'll send out an email to everybody. We'll get a phone conference set up with this committee so we can address this rather than wait till the March 10 meeting.
Okay.
Any additional comments before we move on? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
If I can be... I've been 9 days in Glen, and so we've actually approached Jody's group, and they've been very supportive. I expected to hear no on some monies that need to be spent by June. And so our example of in the process of a renovation and implementation of a new case management system, I guess my point is if I can be of any help illustrating the issue, I'd be happy to on the immediate need to get answers on some of these questions. So
great. Thanks so much. All right. Very good. Zlatko, Judge Smith, thanks so much for your work on that. We look forward to continuing down that road. Okay, we're going to go to item four here. Again, Steve Nash has joined us. We're timing as well. We may end up moving item five to after lunch. We'll see how that goes. There is now public comment on this. I do want to point out to all the committee members, I believe you all know this, but there's public comment been submitted in written form already. I want to make sure that has been distributed to everybody, acknowledge everybody's had a chance to review that. Stephen, we have one public comment behind you. I apologize.
Oh, sure.
That's okay. They signed in this morning. I do want to clarify one thing. Most of this discussion will occur from Judge Kuhl and from Stephen. My reading of the report from the Judicial Council is that the work of the Joint Subcommittee is a recommendation back to each of the committees upon which the co-chairs sit. Judge Kuhl, a member of this committee, is a co-chair of the Joint Subcommittee, and it is now coming back to trial court budget advisory as an action item. I've had some phone calls and concerns, and I understand that the perception is it's coming back before this committee to reopen the item from start, and that's not my intent or this committee's intent. The intent here and the hope here is an informed decision to be made back to this committee. That's why I've asked Stephen to join us today as a subcommittee member. Stephen's simply going to present the information that was permitted to the Joint Subcommittee and what they considered in making their ultimate recommendation. But it's here today as an action item, and I don't think this committee can take action until it's fully informed. That being said, and I'm really sorry, I just couldn't read your name as you signed in.
That's quite all right.
Could you introduce yourself?
You have three minutes.
Thank you so much.
I am Commissioner Rebecca Whiteman. I've been a commissioner handling child support cases in the AB 1058 program since its inception in multiple counties. I've been in San Francisco the last 15 years. And I just wanted to make, I did submit a one-page public comment, but I just wanted, and I do understand the role of this subcommittee, to make just several points to consider both after you've heard presentation from the subcommittee members, that to go back and try to remember this this whole issue. It was on a compressed time frame for the joint subcommittee to bring themselves up to speed about the unique nature of the AB 1058 program, that this is not strictly a numbers issue. I know you hear that all the time when you get people who talk to you or write in, but the Judicial Council has an unprecedented opportunity to work with one of its justice partners, DCSS, who itself is in the process of analyzing its funding allocation on the local child support agency side and whose decisions can impact the workload of all of the trial courts. Equally important to understand and that when you're discussing is that the money here that is being discussed is not trial court budget money. It is money, rather, that comes from state and federal funding that is designated specifically for a program that actually has a performance-based component that is very important to remember when considering what options and what recommendations you may be making to the Judicial Council. I've tried to stress previously, I've written multiple public comments. I don't know if the committee members will have time to look at that, to stress the idea and the importance that the workload issues for agents, for local child support agencies impact trial courts differently. 50,000 cases in one county have a different workload than the same 50,000 cases in another county. There are family law forms, FL 632 and 634, that GPSIS doesn't even know about, and that DCSS's numbers, their own numbers, also may not be accurate. So getting back to the numbers, I did want to point out that issues were raised at the joint subcommittee. I attended all of the meetings with regard to the numbers and whose are better and which one's better, and this one might be better than that, courts numbers versus DCSS numbers. While it was understood that DCSS's numbers are probably better, in fact, Director Griffin did state at the last meeting in November that she did not believe the numbers were necessarily accurate. So it's very important to understand that in context. Lastly, I wanted to... taking a deliberate approach in terms of what the joint subcommittee was recommending, I think is a very responsible one. You don't end up starting down a path, even partial implementation, where you're going to have to change course, or it's a path that you really shouldn't have gone down because of the funding allocations that's going to happen on the other side. Lastly, collaboration is a theme I know our Chief Justice supports. And taking the time to work with one of our justice partners before going down a path seems to be the one that makes the most sense. DCSS, the Department of Child Support Services, after all, is in fact the purse holder. They are and have indicated they would like to, down the road, look for more money for the program overall, so we actually have a bigger pie that the local trial courts can slice up, and to obtain more money for the program overall. So I would urge, and it makes sense not to send the wrong message, to start doing something without working with them. So I would urge this committee to adopt the joint subcommittee's recommendation of option three, which is, I know the other two subcommittees, WAC and FAMJUV, have already weighed in. It would be nice to have a unified approach. Thank you.
Commissioner Reitman, thank you very much. I would like to comment. I was present at the committee where you, the subcommittee earlier, your comments were well thought out and presented as they were today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm going to turn it over to Judge Kuhl. You have the public comments. I just wanted to make sure it's all clear in absolute transparency that the California Court Commissioners Association and the family law facilitator in El Dorado Superior Court have submitted letters, and they both conclude by asking this committee to adopt the recommendations that were submitted. So I'm sure you've all read them, but I just wanted to have everybody reassured that that message has been received by this committee. That being said, Judge Kuhl?
You have a draft memorandum to the council, which provides quite a bit of background. Let me just summarize. First of all, this joint subcommittee grew out of actually the work of Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee. It was on the Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee agenda to look at areas of court funding that were not based on workload. And this was one of the areas that was selected for consideration. The Judicial Council directed that there be a subcommittee with members from this committee, from the Workload Assessment Advisory Committee, and from the Family and Juvenile Advisory Committee to look at the issue of funding for what we call 1058 funding, which funds commissioners to hear child support cases and funds family law facilitators who help litigants with child support matters, but also have the ability to do other family law type advice, self-help to litigants. The first thing the subcommittee did was to understand the origins of this funding. 1997 was when this funding originated. It does flow through Department of Child Support Services. Some of it is federal, some of it is state. And in 1997, the Judicial Council adopted a primarily workload-based funding model for distributing the funding to the various trial courts based on the number of child support matters that were heard. There was a funding floor established as a base funding level based on 0.3 of the commissioner for the commissioner side of the funding. It was contemplated in the report to the Judicial Council that there would be an ongoing review of workload and adjustment based on workload. Our subcommittee found that that never did happen. By the time we got to 2008, this program was flat funded, and a federal drawdown aspect of the funding was put into place. So this is a factor by which certain sums of money are offered to each county on condition that the county put in a third of the funding in order to get two-thirds. And so obviously each of the counties have an option with regard to that excuse me, increment of the funding. The other aspect of this funding that makes it somewhat difficult to administer is the fact that if the funding is not spent in the fiscal year, it goes back. It goes back to the general fund, goes somewhere. We lose the use of it, and so it becomes very important to distribute the money in a way that allows for all of the money to be used in each fiscal year by the court that receives the money. So fairly early on in the deliberations, we had a subcommittee of our subcommittee that looked at the issue of mid-year redistribution of funding so that all the money would be used in a particular year, and I think Jose chaired that subcommittee. The recommendation with regard to redistribution is number 3 of the recommendations, and the committee was unanimous with regard to that recommendation. On the issue of how the 1058 money should be distributed, we started with the realization that we were dealing, at least now, with a set sum of money. And you'll recall Judge Cope earlier talked about the size of the pie versus cutting up the pie. This is an area where we made the assumption that we had a particular size of the pie that we were cutting up, and therefore that there was not a need to do a workload measurement of the sort that the Workload Assessment Advisory Committee did, but rather to look at workload numbers of the various counties and their percentages of the whole. We discussed what the best measurement of that workload would be. We talked about GBSIS numbers. There was concern by committee members that counties trial courts were not necessarily reporting all of the transactions that would be counted as available for 1058 funding, because many of those child support transactions come up in the course of a family law case. And for that reason, the committee decided at that juncture to look at the workload numbers of the Department of Child Support Services. I'd like to disagree a bit with what Commissioner Reitman just said. The head of the Department of Child Support Services certainly made the point that she did not think that their numbers told the whole story about workload. However, it was clear from her presentation to the committee that she was not challenging her own caseload numbers. And I think she was very careful about that, because those are the numbers that they submit to the federal government with respect to their own federal funding. So I don't think she undermined the numbers themselves. At this point, the committee agreed that we would use the Department of Child Support Services numbers to try to develop a workload-based funding formula. And then by vote of the committee, there was an agreement on the elements that are at the bottom of page 6 of your materials. That there would be a there would be a comparative workload data based on the DCSS caseload statistics, that we would factor in differences for local cost of labor as we do in the WAFM formula using the BLS factor, that there would be a minimum funding floor for smaller courts, and that we would look at various options for phase in of any funding model that would be selected. So at that point, a very hard-working subcommittee of our subcommittee was formed, and Stephen Nash chaired that group, which did a lot of hard work. Before we go to Stephen, Judge Conklin was a member of the subcommittee. Is there anything else we should say at this point by way of background?
No, I think it's a great background, and again, we're just trying to get the same information out, and I think Stephen can do that for us.
Right.
Okay, thank you very much. The subcommittee of the subcommittee of the subcommittee, joining me on that was Rebecca Fleming, Stanislaus CEO, Jose Guillen from Sonoma, and also from Sonoma, Commissioner Louise Fightmaster. And the hard part of the work, really, and the real brains behind the operation were the staff. And we had great support from Dina Feroli, Colin Simpson, and Anna Maves. Now, I've been asked to subject you to what other bodies of folks got subjected to, and I know you're up to it. So I'm going to be taking you through this model that was developed, which means we're going to be going through tables and charts. I'm going to walk you through slowly all of the assumptions, the data, the calculations to get us to what ultimately are preliminary preliminary allocation recommendations that were presented. But before that, I have some comments. Going back a little bit, revisiting a little bit of the territory that Judge Kuhl gave you, our subcommittee started out saying, okay, what data, where did this model come from? The current allocation process we have, what data was used? And the report that was discussed earlier, May 2nd, 1997, was presented and the recommendations ultimately approved by the Judicial Council. That's prior to trial court funding, almost 19 years ago. In that report, it was a workload-based report that established the allocations for the statewide for the Child Support Commissioner Program. And then using the exact same data, the same methodology and the same data, they applied that to the Family Law Facilitator Program. And so that's the basis for those allocations. At that time, though, just as what we looked at and the subcommittee looked at, there were a lot of questions about what was the right data, what was the best data. That group and that report ultimately settled on the information that was provided by each county's district attorney. So we live in a different world than they did. We now have Department of Child Support Services and they have the local agencies. At that time, it was district attorneys that ran the child support program. And not only did they run it, but then, of course, they reported on it. The report that the Judicial Council ultimately had to vote on and the methodology that was the basis for the allocation that more or less we still live with today was this information that the Department of Social Services, not Child Support Services, but Department of Social Services compiled from the district attorneys. And that was the 4D active pending child support cases. And it was interesting, just as you would have in any of this, because we all know there's never perfect information. We can all stipulate to that. At the time, there was some level of controversy about the information being used and the funding that would result from the allocations. Also, interestingly, as a side note, one young whippersnapper executive officer's letter in mild protest, Mike Roddy, at that time the Superior Court and Municipal Courts of Sacramento, and he had a series of concerns at that time that were voiced and expressed. But like I say, it figures prominently into that report. Let's cover those. One of the things that was very clear in that report was an assumption that there would be reallocations, that this wasn't to set the process in stone, that they were tying this to caseloads, the caseloads for the child support process program, and it was to be revisited. It was to be updated with information. There are some continuities, so there's a lot of difference when you look back 19 years, but there's some continuities. The report also said, gee, it would be great if we had great court information instead of relying on this information from district attorneys that goes through the Department of Social Services. But, gee, we should work on that over the next couple of years. Well, 19 years later, the subcommittee found that the information still isn't there. It's not consistent. It's not reported in a comprehensive way. And it was the director of the Department of Child Support Services that not only said we should be using the caseload information, but in reviewing our numbers, our preliminary numbers, said you're using the wrong ones. The right numbers are in this column. And so I do want to point that out as well. Okay. Again, covering a little bit of the territory that was already discussed, our subgroup was given four parameters. I'm going to walk through how those reveal themselves in the model. First off, it had to be a workload-based allocation using Department of Child Support Services caseload statistics. We had to have the local cost of labor adjustment to reflect the fact that there are challenges depending on where the court and jurisdiction is located. That there would be a minimum funding floor, and that it be phased in over time to the extent that there's going to be any reallocations that be indicated, you should approach it over time. As we as a subcommittee started to look at the information and the data and started to get our arms around all of that, we adopted some principles. First off, where possible, we weren't going to reinvent the wheel. So we would mirror methodologies and factors used in the statewide WAFM computations, which are the basis of our overall baseline funding, for purposes of consistency and also ease of communication and understanding. Second, we were not developing an allocation. We were developing an allocation process, and I will come back to a recommendation. I'll come back to that a little bit, and you'll understand at that point what I'm talking about. And then finally, the federal drawdown component, that there's the two pieces, the base funding and the federal drawdown. We would apply the similar process and principles to the federal drawdown allocation as the baseline allocation. So there ultimately was four pots of money. There is the base and the drawdown for the Child Support Commissioner. I'm going to walk you through each one of these pieces. And then there's the base and the drawdown for the Family Law Facilitator Program. Now the fun begins. So if you roll up your sleeves and if you turn to combined 58, so we're going to go, there's a lot of pages, but we're going to cover a lot in the first couple of pages, and then we'll speed up. The first stop I want to take you to is 62, then we'll come back to 58. It displays it slightly different. On page 62, you should see each court array. All of these are going to be obviously by court alphabetically, but the first column of data, DCSS caseload, fiscal year 2013, and does everybody say that? DCSS caseload 2014, DCSS caseload 2015, and then we do a three-year average. And that's one of the processes that's done in WAFM. We do that because for some cases, especially the smaller courts with smaller caseload, there can be tremendous variation one year to the next in the cases. This is the smoothing. Again, it's a concept that's in WAFM. We apply it here. We think it's very appropriate, and we apply it here. So we start off with that DCSS caseload, and as you see, there's a three-year averaging. Now, if you'll go back to page 58, the difference between the two, page 58 just starts with that three-year average, and I wanted you to see how we got to that. So again, this line 17 DCSS caseload, this is what the director of DCSS recommended that we use. It's the best information. Not only that, our local DCSS, I spent time with them talking about and going over all this information and data, and they said, this is the best you've got. It is audited. There's consistency and coherence statewide. It's just got all of the strengths that we're hoping to achieve in our court-based data related to this one of these days. So you can see the starting point then is that three-year average DCSS caseload. Then what we do is say, and on the second page, the page right after that, you'll see they total up to 86,675 cases pending statewide. And so the next column after the three-year average is simply saying for each court, what's your percentage of the statewide caseload data? And looking at Alameda, you can see they had 2,308 cases. That equates to 2.66% of the statewide allocation. Then what the next column, so right now I should tell you, so we're going to be, as I told you, we're doing four pieces. We're going to be doing four different allocation recommendation computations. The first one we're doing right now is Child Support Commissioner. So with the Child Support Commissioner, this is the base funding, which doesn't require a match. The total money that we have is $32.125 million. The total that's provided for the court system for base funding for the Child Support Commissioner is $32,125,000. So under pro rata Child Support Commissioner base allocation, all that is you take the $32,125,000 and you say if Alameda, without looking at current, if they have 2.66% of the workload, what would they have if they had 2.66% of that pot? And you can see that's $855,578. Then, so what we've done, we've accomplished the first one, which was DCSS caseload. Now we're going to go into that second parameter that we had, which said that you need to do a cost of living adjustment. Once again, we go back to WAFM, and we use a process that was done there. And what we're doing is looking at, really, cost of labor, and we use the exact same methodology that it's done for WAFM. So under support salary only, 43% of base. So what staff did was they had looked at actual expenditures, actual AB 1058 expenditures by court, and they determined that 43% of the total was salaries. Now, it's actually a little bit bigger. It's salaries plus certain fringe benefits, plus in some courts where they use contracts to cover some of these services, those are also included. And so of the total expenditures that courts report, actual expenditures, 43% are salaries, with one exception, and that is this does not include any funding for the Child Support Commissioner. Commissioners throughout the state, largely, it's not a statutory requirement anymore, but largely are 85% of judges' salary. And in looking at the actual reported information, that was largely consistent. So we're not adjusting the Child Support Commissioner salary. We're adjusting the support position, support staff. That's the 43%. So you take 43%. So again, looking at all of statewide, it's 43% non-Child Support Commissioner salaries. You apply that times the pro rata base allocation. So you say, okay, Alameda, if you had 855,000, we would assume that 366,000 is the cost of salary and these other salary-like items we were talking about. And then we would apply the factor that is used in WAFM to adjust cost of labor. That's the BLS factor. That is the Bureau of Labor Standards adjustment for public sector and government compensation index. The number you have here is the exact same number that the council had approved and we use in the WAFM. So they took the exact same factor and applied it here. So you can see it's 366,000 in the case of Alameda. But what this factor says is Alameda is in a high-cost area for government employees. It's much higher. The factor is 1.42. You multiply the 1.42 times the 366,000, and that bumps them up to 520,000. Another example that we may come back to, Amador. Amador, you can see that using the U.S. BLS standards is 1, so they're right at the standard. There's no adjustment. So their 43% is 13,335, and so there's no adjust. They're at 13,335 after that adjustment. Then what you do, so remember, we started with going back to Alameda. We had 855,578. If they had an unadjusted percentage based on the reflective of the percentage of their workload, but now we've bumped up a component of it, right? And so you take the 366,000 plus the unadjusted amount. That gets you to total adjusted base allocation, 1,009,486. You don't have all the calculation, all the pluses and minuses, but again, what we did is we, out of that 855, we took 43%, we adjusted it in the case of, for all the courts, but in the case of Alameda by 1.42 increase, and then we add it back to the 855, and that gives us 1,009,000 for them. Looking back at Amador, remember they were at 31,134. We said that the BLS factor doesn't change them. It's 1.0, so they're still at 31,134. So now we have a total adjusted base allocation. That's a computed number. It went through these processes that we just talked about, but now we have a problem. Because if you take that total adjusted base allocation, no floor, I'm all the way on the right-hand side now, and you add all that up, that adds up to 34,356. Well, the problem is we only have 32.125 million, so we're going to have to figure that out. So now if you'll turn to page 60. So... now we're going to go, so we're not done yet before we now have to do the floor, to provide a floor for courts with very small caseloads. And the floor that was originally approved, that was the basis of the initial judicial council allocation to the courts, was 0.3 times a commissioner. That's what each jurisdiction would be guaranteed, minimum 0.3%. And then remember, the family law facilitator program was piggybacked on that, so they also had a 0.3. So our group, in looking and just kind of starting over and looking at things, we said we can't, at this point, we can't justify changing that. That's the process in place. But we did get concerned because what was originally done, they took the 0.3 and then applied it also to support staff. And where that became a problem for our group, and it wasn't included in our recommendation to our joint committee, was because when you do that to the full support staff, you ended up with, in a couple of examples, where you would have a court with 1/25th the workload, but it would have 30% of the filing of a neighboring court. 1/25th of the workload, 30%. So we took a second look at it and we said, leave the point three commissioner, and you'll see we'll say leave the point three family law facilitator when we get to that, but not the support staff. So the point three times the cost of the family the commissioner is $62,558. So what this does is say adjusted base greater than the floor. So all of those adjusted bases that we had on the right-hand column on the prior pages, we now compare to $62,558.3 times commissioner's compensation cost. And if it's below, then in that if no column, it's $62,558. That's the floor. You're guaranteed $62,558. But if you're above, then you're going to be in that third column, adjusted base allocation. That's just the same number we saw on the right-hand column in the earlier pages. It's just carried forward. So you're either above the 62,000, you get that number. Alameda again shows up at that. That's that 1,009. Now is where it gets a little tricky, because I told you we were out of balance. That. And so now we got to squeeze these numbers back. We got to prorate these numbers back to get within the compensation that's available. But why it gets a little tricky is we also established a floor. We're saying you're not going to go below the floor. So the prorating occurs only for those courts that don't have the floor. So that column, adjusted base allocation excluding floor courts, adds up to $33,697,000. But remember, we need the total, and the floor adds up to 1.188, and we've got to get all that down to 32,125. So that's the process. The percent of total adjusted base allocation, this is a different number. Again, we're going to prorate. We're going to be adjusting those courts that are above the floor. Adjusted salary rescaled to the available allocation. So that's the process going from the adjusted base allocation, $33,697,000. We're only prorating those courts that are above the floor, and now we've prorated it to $30,937,000. $30,937,000 plus the $1.188 million floor courts gets you to a total adjusted base allocation with a floor of $32.125 million. Which is the available funds. That's the next to last column that you see. So we've gone through all of those parameters, all of the things that we were charged to do, and within the available funds. And by the way, when we get through this, then I will give you the results to show how this stacks up against the historical allocation that we're all living with. The next part you're gonna like, though, don't turn the page yet. The next part you're gonna like. Because that was the base allocation for child support commissioner. The drawdown is the next column. All we've done in the drawdown, because we've already prorated the full cost of the staff, all we do here is say, this one is the cleanest, the drawdown's the cleanest. We say, we go back to that original calculation and we say, what's your Alameda, what's your percentage of the total statewide workload, apply that in this case to 8,073. That's the total statewide pot that's available for drawdown for child support commissioner program. And so you can see arrayed based on their share of statewide workload using the metric of the Department of Child Support Services information, caseload information, 8.073. So those last two columns are the full, under this model, this would be the recommended preliminary allocation, and I'll explain why I keep using that word, for both the base and the drawdown. And remember the drawdown, why that's broken out, that this represents only the federal money, the federal share. The court would still have to come up with its third, there's going to be decisions that would have to be made if there is a reallocation. Alameda, looking at $215,000, the question to them would be, are you going to come up with a third to match the $215,000? It's essentially half that number. Are you going to come up with that? You're going to commit to that. And so this one, again, the drawdown requires the federal match. Now let's go to page 62. Now we can start to speed up, because now we're going to do the exact same thing. Family law facilitator, it's the exact same process. So we've got the 3 years of DCSS caseload, the exact same average, nothing has changed. Just as in, again, the way the money's been allocated originally, it was based on both the family law facilitator and the child support commission were based on this information. I want to say, though, this isn't the same. When you look back, well, I'll get to that in a minute. So we have 3 year caseload. Again, the percentage is the same. We're repeating the same information in terms of statewide workload. Now we come up with the pro rata base allocation. Here it's different. 91% of the total family law facilitator, that's a different number, a bigger number, because we're not excluding the child support. This doesn't relate to the child support commissioner. Family law facilitator compensation, when you look at it, does differ court to court, and so they're plugged into that. They're included in this adjustment. And then we apply those same old, looking at Alameda, 1.42 again, Amador, 1.0 again. Same adjustment, do the salary adjustment, and we come up with the total adjusted base allocation. We still have the same problem, because in this case, the total available is $10.99 million. Once you've done those adjustments for the salary, we now have $12.6 million. So we're going to have to, again, go back to those transformations that we did earlier. So if you go to page 64... now we apply the floor again. The floor here, 0.3 times the average compensation statewide of a family law facilitator, and you can see that's $45,597. And so you know the process. If you're above it, you show up in that third column that we're now going to prorate. Otherwise, you get the $45,597. Maybe I'll just take a sidestep real quick. One thing that you'll see in the report, when we presented this at the Joint Committee originally, we got a lot of feedback. And it was like 26 letters of folks that were concerned. And we read them, and we read them very carefully. And Nevada pointed out something that was not consistent with what we had intended as a joint subcommittee to be recommending, that courts that have combined programs, Alpine El Dorado, for example, Amador Calaveras, and it was Nevada, Sean Matroka pointed out, you're penalizing us because by combining us, we don't get the floor. And that's not fair, and that was not our intent. So the numbers you have now, that's the only adjustment from what we presented to the Joint Committee. That was not what was intended, and so we have fixed that. So that's why you see Alpine and then Alpine El Dorado. We've split it out so, because Alpine by itself gets the $45,597 and Nevada as well. So then we do the same transformations, and then the far two right columns are the total adjusted base allocation, which now is $10.99 million, and the drawdown, which splits based on 100% based on that percentage of workload, $2.759 million. So now we've just come up with preliminary computations for all four pots of money. The two for the child support commissioner, the drawdown on the base, and the two for the family law facilitator, the drawdown on the base. Now let's look at the results. If you go to page 66, what we've done here, this just takes the information, those allocation computations, preliminary computations that we talked about, and it compares it to that historical allocation that's in place. So the historical allocation going back to, again, right on the eve of trial court funding, there have been ad hoc adjustments to it over time, but again, nothing systematic, nothing comprehensive. And so we look at that current historical allocation, and you can see the result. So this first is the court support, the child support commissioner allocation base, So you can see Alameda, just sticking with them, 926 is what we computed. Their historical is 1,055. That would be a 12.2% reduction for them for the base allocation for the child support commissioner. Going across the, continuing across the chart, the workload on the drawdown, we showed how we got that, 215,000. They currently get an allocation of 344. That'd be a reduction of 37.6 of that. The third group of columns is the total allocation, just puts that, those all together. And so Alameda in total, we're talking about looking at workload, it would be 1.141 million. Historically, they were 1.4 when you put the drawdown and the base together, and that would be an 18.4% difference. Now, one of the things that, I'll hold on a second. Let's go to page 68, and we'll look at the family law facilitator by court. So again, looking at Alameda, their workload-based calculation that we saw a minute ago, 326,500. Historical, 369,000. That's 11.5% reduction. The draw down, they would be dropped by 31.5% under this computation. And you can see the total allocation for the family law facilitator for Alameda would be a minus 16%. So we've done three of those parameters, but remember, so this is the preliminary computation, but then there's one that we hadn't got to yet, a phase in over time. So all of these numbers then, so if you'll turn to page 70, and then we presented some options to phase in. And so sticking with Alameda, the base allocation, if you did it as 3-year evenly spread, and again, this is a concept that was used in WAFM. If you did it over 3 years, though, and you, so you're mixing the new workload computation, percentage of the workload computation, mixing it with a percentage of the historical, and you're just phasing it over time. So at 33% workload, you can see with Alameda going from 1,055 to 1,012 on the base. Year two, they would be down to 969, and year three, when it's 100% workload base, then they would get to the numbers that we just saw on the prior chart. We do that also, as you can see, for the drawdown, and then again, set up the same way, then we just put the two together, and we're calling that the total allocation, what a 3-year phase-in would look like. So we do that for the courts over time. Then we also offered, so if you turn to page 72, another option, which is 4-year, which was 25% workload, 75% historical, 50-50, 75, and then year 4, you would be at the full workload-based. And then we were also asked to have one that was kind of backloaded. And on page 74, that one says start with 4-year, 15% the first year, move to 45% workload-based, then 70% workload-based by year 3, and then by year 4. So you can see it phases in even slower over time. And then that's the child support commissioner, and then the rest of the pages do the exact same thing for the family law facilitator. So that's the model that we've come up with that met those parameters that we walked people through and presented. A couple of takeaways that I'd like to leave you with when I think about this. First off, what is it? What is this model? One way of looking at it is a diagnostic or a descriptive. As a descriptive tool, when you look at the difference between workload allocation that's largely based on calculations from 1997, 19 years ago, to upgraded, stronger information, better and more consistent from a statewide basis, but guess what? we are a different California demographically than we were 19 years ago as well. There have been changes, we all know, not only in the child support program, but also statewide. What you end up with, keeping that in mind, and you, looking at this as a diagnostic tool, that the current allocation is substantially out of whack, substantially inconsistent with the way dollars are allocated statewide. Leaving you with what we're currently having now, again, it's not to criticize the model that was put in place 19 years ago, but you're still that's your grandpa's Oldsmobile. So we're left with a suboptimal allocation in the current period. The second one is, again, I said it before, this was not intended to be an allocation recommendation. It was an allocation calculation as the first step to a process. So what we had recommended was you go through that process, and there are winners and there are losers. I will tell you that the losers were in the 40s out of 58 courts. And that's largely driven by some of the level of inequities, but also some of the winners are larger courts and that where there's considerable growth. Those changes, whether plus or minus for courts, especially on the plus side, there was a lot of concern. Well, that's great, but how do we know Sacramento's one of the courts? How do we know they need that big of a shot in the arm of resources, especially when it's being reallocated from somebody else? The intent was not to say, Sacramento, here's the money you have to use to do your program. It was exactly the opposite. It was to say, here's what the calculations would be if the workload with all the adjustments we talked about were done fairly and equitably, but it would be incumbent upon you, Sacramento, San Bernardino, Riverside, Kern, if you agree that that money is, that's the basis for a program, you would have to do two things. One, come up with a realistic implementation plan over time, identifying when you would hire people, what the program would do towards achieving the goals of the Title IV-D money, a realistic implementation plan and timeline, and you would be making a commitment that you would operationalize that, and any federal drawdown match, you would be committing up front. None of this, what we have now, are these historical drawdown allocations, and then courts decide at the end of the year, we don't have the money, and then they leave it on the table. None of that would be happening. You would be committed up front. If you're going to take a larger slice of the pie, you would be committing to that up front, because every dollar you take that's allocated to you, Sacramento or whatever other court, is less money for somebody else. We believe it's without doubt the case that either in the implementation of rolling out a more equitable program in these communities, in the timeline of implementing it, or in some cases, and this is what some of the staff and others had asserted, they're just more efficient there. They don't need as much money. Maybe that's true, and maybe that's the judgment of the court. And to the extent that's the case, so the first phase, you do the calculation to come up with what an equitable allocation would look like. The second is, say, courts that would receive funds, what would it look like if you got those? How soon would you be productively putting those funds into operation? And what level of commitment are you making? But any funds that they are not, either because of the time of implementation or because they're not interested in doing the drawdown match, or they're not interested in that level of program, that money would be put back in the pot for those courts that are going down. That's why I say this isn't an allocation calculation, it's a process. Also, I promised Jake last time, and I'm going to live up to it again. This is not RAS. because one important piece of RAS comes up with a cost, an estimated cost. Judge Good's always good at reminding me of that back in our court. It identifies an estimated cost to provide that level of services. This doesn't do that. This short circuits that. It just simply says, what's your share of workload using the metrics we talked about versus what's your share of money that's been allocated. So the last thing I want to say, so we ended up with 40-some courts that would lose money. That staff have looked at that and run different scenarios, and I will tell you that is largely driven by that floor that I told you about. And if the floor was set differently and they ran different models, depending on where the floor is set, you end up with 27-27, half and half, winners and losers. It really was governed by that. We did what we thought made the most sense looking at it as a small group. But again, that would be another way of looking at this, is it's really talking about where the floor is, because that's a critical component of all of this. The last thing, though, when you looked at the winners and the losers, what's really striking, to me not surprising, but striking, is how much it matches the results of RAS. What you see largely is those developed urban coastal communities, some of the money, and this really describes the demographic changes in California. There would be a shift to, not a surprise, a lot of courts in the Inland Empire, well, two courts in the Inland Empire, and the Central Valley, where, guess what? Tremendous growth. 1997, when Mike Roddy didn't have to use a bottle. Teasing, Mike. I know you don't use a bottle. In 1997, it was a different California. The population has changed dramatically since then. And of course, it's been in the inland areas of California. So, I think that was the walkthrough that I wanted to leave you with.
Excellent.
Oh, and the last piece was we were recommending that this be revisited. And I know that was part of the original report to the council, but that it should be revisited and revised with updated information periodically, at least every 3 to 5 years. That was it.
Stephen, thank you so much. I appreciate that. Before I turn back to Judge Kuhl to summarize essentially the decision of the joint subcommittee, I believe Jose wanted to make a quick comment.
Just a quick comment. One, I want to really thank Stephen for shepherding this process. I mean, he downplayed staff as being collaborating and providing the input, but he really, his vision was really huge in this, so thank you. The only comment that I would have is that while we're using DCSS data and we have gotten consensus from those that have used it and validated that this is a good starting point, given the plan of cooperation that is being required for the courts to enter with DCSS, that we should take a close look at making sure that we develop our own internal data that we feel comfortable with and that we validate, whether it be GIPSIS or some other caseload data. While we want to collaborate with DCS because they do have the purse string, we should not allow ourselves to be infringed upon our independent court administration and due process because of the budget. I recommend that you look at your plan of cooperation. We have been in negotiations with DCSS, and they have told me that if you don't sign it, we'll take this money away from you. So the lesson here is, let's not allow the benevolent king and sign a plan of cooperation to turn out into a tyrant king who will later use a different matrix
performance that they control as opposed to us controlling it.
Rebecca, did you want to add anything? You were also on the work.
I'm just nodding feverishly,
okay.
Yes.
Okay.
I'd like to make a couple comments. I was on the subcommittee. I was assigned as a member of the WAC. I was Humboldt County's commissioner since its inception in 1997 until I was elected judge in 2008. First, I have a question about the subcommittee process. The subcommittee heard Stephen Nash's comments and then heard a whole lot more information. After hearing all that information, the subcommittee made their recommendation. If, in fact, the parent committees, so to speak, get to kind of go rogue and hear only part of the presentation and make a different recommendation, I haven't questioned why we have subcommittees. So I'm not sure what's being asked of this committee today. Child support is a significant issue at the state and federal level. When the child support support system was created in California, they decided to go judicial instead of administrative, which was actually a pretty big deal at the time. It doesn't have to do that all the time. It could decide that partnering with the judicial branch is a mistake and decide to create their whole new system. In fact, that may be part of the evaluation result that they come up with at the end of their longer study. And we were told that California ranks 49th in the nation as far as efficiency with child support services. And so that number is looked at closely by the governor and the legislature. And if the result of the DCSS evaluation is, well, we're 49th because the courts are the problem, that doesn't help us either individually with child support issues or in the big picture of where we want the branch to be in the long run. Performance measures are a real part of the child support services system. It's not just about carving up the money fairly between the courts. After hearing everything that was presented, and that was a lot of opposition comments from smaller counties about the issues, not just what we've heard today, the recommendation after a lot of discussion was to take a step back, to look at the issue more closely, ideally using our own experts, who in fact I think are the child support commissioners in our individual courts, and join with DCSS to maybe look at a whole new way of looking at this where we create win-wins for both the DCS, the Department of Child Support Services, and of the courts. More importantly, better meet the needs of the folks who critically need child support awarded to them in a timely manner. So I think that my feeling is that while we've heard additional information today, we haven't heard everything, and that the subcommittee took a lot of time to met three times, at least I, and heard a lot of information to come up with the recommendation. And if the idea is that we come up with something different, we shouldn't do so lightly, because I really feel like if we take that step back, talk about it with our commissioners who are directly involved, that we could come up with a process that's better than what we have now, and really could show how when we do that and join with our justice partners that there are results that are better. So I think this is bigger than carving up money, and I would think that we should adopt the recommendations of the subcommittee.
And I just want to clarify, Judge Heinrichs, as you started your comments, and I truly appreciate mm-hmm. that, I was trying, as I started this discussion, trying to set forth, and this is the information that was provided in the room that day from Stephen Nash, that I thought this, my reading of the dictate of the Judicial Council, I used the term favorably, the direction to this committee was each committee make its own recommendation. And I felt it therefore appropriate for this committee to have the information that was in the room. Now, candidly, and you are correct, or transparently, there was significant support in the room that day for the recommendation that's before this committee today.
And the only thing that I want to add then is that you need to tell people that present to a subcommittee that, you know what, there's going to be this, there's three committees that are represented here. So you're going to need to make sure that you watch each of the committee's recommendations so that you can come when it's questioned and represent what you did before if it's a de novo look at all those things.
Okay, and I'm going to turn it back to Judge Kuhl for a response to that.
So, I think, well, it's not really a response. I'm agreeing in a sense to Judge Heinrichs in that we didn't really finish the story, right? So we had set forth parameters at our third meeting that were provided to the subcommittee that Stephen Nash chaired as to what we thought a workload model should look like. So something must have happened between then and the recommendation, because as you see in your materials, the recommendation is to not do anything along the lines of a workload model at this time. So
at the last meeting, Judge Hendricks is right, there was opposition from a variety of courts. You've seen some of that, but not to the same extent in the materials here. Ms. Alicia Griffin, who was a member of our joint subcommittee, although someone who is not with the court. She's the chair of the Department of Child Support Services, made a presentation and said that her organization had hired a consultant to do a two-year evaluation of their operations to look for efficiencies and to look for innovations that might affect their own resources distribution. And suggested that the court should wait and should go with the department and watch them, if you will, or participate with them, however it would work out, in their own evaluation where they hope to think about their own redistribution of funds. And that they might, although we had a very direct conversation with Ms. Griffiths, and her deputy said they had not yet committed to seek additional funds, but at the end of that analysis, they might seek additional funds. I think there was one other aspect that's worth mentioning, and that is with respect to the facilitator data. We had asked early on whether there was any breakdown for the amount of work that child support facilitators do on child support cases, as opposed to the work that they're also permitted to do on family law cases in ways that don't directly relate to child support. And we could not get any breakdown of that data. That would be very useful, and you'll see in the comments of the Workload Assessment Advisory Committee after their review that they are of the view that that is definitely something the court should undertake in the future. So I think... And other people here were at that meeting and should weigh in as to how the decision turned on a 10-5 vote in the final analysis.
Right, it was, and that is how it turned. And again, the recommendation before you today received substantial support in the room. And when we talk about opposition, there was the mirror of that is there was opposition in the room that day to the new method proposed. So the ultimate, and I'm overgeneralizing, but at the end of the day, the vote was to go with the recommendation before you on page 2, combined page 47. Rick?
Yeah, and there certainly was a lot of discussion on the other side. And I mean, personally, if you look at just strictly filing, let me back up even more. First of all, again, like Jose, I'd like to thank Stephen and that subcommittee. I mean, they did a very, very good job based upon the direction that we gave them as a subcommittee and the information that was provided. And they came back with absolutely what I would have expected them to come back with. But in looking at the way the numbers came out once we did see them, and I'll focus more on the facilitator program rather than the commissioner program, and I do that because I think it is more reasonable to look at number of filings for the commissioner program because courts are the only entity in counties that perform that function, and a case in one county, it can be very similar to a case in another. But when you look at facilitator sorts of services, I'm not so sure that criteria is as applicable. And if you go to page 69 of your materials, I'll kind of point out an example that was striking to me. And if you look at three courts that are listed right at the bottom, being Yuba, Yolo, and Tuolumne, and what the results were, you see that they all end up with basically a very similar allocation, two of which are at the floor, one of which just under the floor. And if you apply the criteria of just number of filings, and you come up with kind of an average amount of funding per filing, if my calculations are correct, you find that Yolo, just above the floor, ends up about $105 per filing. Yuba, with their caseload, similar sort of amount of money, but ends up with $162 per filing. But Tuolumne, with their workload, ends up at $241. So if you kind of compare counties on that basis, it may not make a lot of sense because of the differences in the average funding per case. You know, you have YOLO, then you have Yuba that gets about 50% more, then you got Tuolumne that gets about 140% more, which that doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. And I think what you see there, that might be appropriate because unlike the commissioner program, facilitator services are so entwined with other resources in their local community. And you might have a county with a caseload in a large urban area, and there's legal aid available, there are volunteer attorneys available, and other sorts of services that can really augment the self-help center. And I can speak from experience, in Tuolumne, we had none of that. We had no legal aid, the attorneys were not involved. The self-help center was the only resource available to pro-purpose litigants. So it might be appropriate to give them that amount of funding. But I think what our committee really felt, at least I thought as far as the facilitator program in particularly, is that these factors, you really need to have a wider look at various factors to come up with some recommendations to come to a level of funding.
Thank you. Dr. Cole, anything further?
No, I just think if other members of the committee, of the subcommittee who are on this committee, wanted to add any description of the processes.
Jose or Rebecca? So I will point out in your materials at page 8, so this is where, as I read the initial request, there was a report back to each subcommittee. The Workload Assessment Advisory Committee has since considered the recommendation, and they have voted, and I'm just reading the materials you have, voted unanimously to support all of the recommendations. The Family and Juvenile Law Advisory Committee considered it, and they, again, likewise appreciated the work, and they adopted or agreed, they discussed, or pardon me, voted that the recommendations be adopted as well. They also indicated a friendly amendment that WAC was considering. Is that a substantial amendment, or do we know?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I think it is just looking forward at what, from the workload assessment standpoint, they're going to propose to look at with respect to facilitator data.
So then you'll all see the highlighted portion is the space is reserved to include a report back from our committee. That's why we had this discussion today. Sherry.
Stephen, I just want to thank you for doing so, and whomever else is on that, Jose and Rebecca, that you did such a great job. I personally support the process that you talked about. I think it's more than an allocation methodology by far. If the process was going to be to have the courts develop a plan to come in or not, because we are leaving money on the table with our drawdown when people are not using their drawdown, and it does not make the branch look good because people are not committing, and this would be a way to almost revitalize that. So I think you did a great job. Thank you so much. I think it's unfortunate that we compare, that we have charts that compare historical with proposed funding, because I have always tried to get the branch, when we've looked at various funding models, to try to say what is the right thing to do. What should it be based on? And when we start looking at our own individual counties, it really takes the focus away from the model we should be moving toward. And so I always am sad to see that we have to do it because we have to see the impact, but it's almost too bad that that's part of the discussion, because then it makes us focus at home rather than focus branch-wide on what it should look like. So with that said, when you get to the recommendations, I would appreciate you breaking them into three, because I can support some and I cannot support others.
I'll do that. And I know Judge Earl is on the phone. She asked to be heard. Judge Earl, are you still with us?
I am, and I have a question for any of you who were on the joint working group. You indicated that DCFS is going to embark, or maybe already has embarked on this assessment of their caseload. I think it's caseload data. And what I'm wondering is if that could change the caseload data numbers that the methodology that Stephen walked us through is based on. Does that make sense?
Yeah, this is Rebecca. I think the answer is yes, it could, because we were not given a lot of data as to what they were looking at. Correct me if I'm wrong, Judge Kuhl, but I think it was described as a complete review of all of their data and what they're submitting, and it was going to take a 2-year process. So I think the answer is probably yes, it could.
I'm sorry, Judge Earle. This is Judge Kuhl. I had the strong impression that Ms. Griffin stood by her numbers in terms of counting what they actually do right now. And I think it was important for her to do that because those are the numbers that they submit to the federal government with respect to their federal funding. My sense was that what they would be looking at would be things like, do certain types of proceedings take longer than other types of proceedings? And so should they, in thinking about their own operations, weight certain types of proceedings differently from others? But in particular, what she talked about was efficiencies and innovations. She talked about case management systems and those kinds of things, which I would not think that aspect of it would affect the counting of the number of case matters.
What I'm trying to understand is also what was the basis of the objection from the counties that objected and from DCFS? I'm trying to figure out why were they objecting to the proposed workload formula and a phased-in approach to that?
Stephen, go ahead.
Judge Earle, this is Stephen Nash. I can speak to some of the comments. There was tremendous concern about the disruptive element of doing a reallocation like this. And even phased in over time, the notion was that you're really, it's going to be very disruptive for existing programs. And I think it ties with what Judge Henricks was saying, that there was concern that we would be out of step with what DCSS is doing as they're looking at their whole process and supposedly reinventing themselves over the next couple of years. And they didn't want us to get ahead of their own potential reallocation process. So, again, the disruptive element of a model that programs that are in place. There also was stated, as Commissioner Whiteman said earlier, concern that, there's different level of services provided in different communities, and you'd be impacting those communities without a greater level of data and information. And, you know, that's always true. And the way we thought about it there's always more than just the data. But at the end of the day, you've got to use something for an allocation. And so the council had used something 19 years ago. But it is a moving target. I think there was just tremendous concern about the fact, again, so you're going to be impacting programs, and this is a moving target.
Mike?
Just a question on a different track, just because I'm new to this whole piece. But I'm curious to know, I think Judge Hendricks made a comment that California's ranked 49th in what? What was the measure? And getting more to the issue of what do people perceive the problem to be? Or where?
I'm not exactly sure because Alicia Griffin's not here to answer the question, but I think what it is that there's performance measures as when you ask for child support, how quickly do you get money in people's pockets or hands from the process when it starts? And that our process takes, and that may not, it takes 49, so it's like how many uncollected child support debts do you have? How many, how quickly do you get to a judgment? How quickly does money flow? So there's combined measures that look at all those, and actually all our counties are looked at individually, and they could tell you where your county fits with those measures as well. I was just looking, so that's the answer question. I have some more comments later, but.
Judge Kaufman?
I was surprised, when this came out Monday, I started getting a lot of phone calls from various people in the small courts, very concerned about this. So the optics of this, what we're doing today, really bothers me, is yes, we have a right as this committee to decide what we want to do. I don't begrudge that at all. Is the way we're doing it is that this report comes out on Monday. The subgroup met in, I guess, November. Mm-hmm. So here we are basically 2 months later, and all of a sudden on Monday we're thrown this, and then basically everybody starts calling and emails start, et cetera. And then we have to make a decision today. And a decision that basically, if we adopt this, that basically is a takeaway from over 40 courts. That's a very serious decision to make in such a short period of time.
And I'm sorry to interrupt you, but when you say adopt this, the recommendation here is that, in fact, there be no change. So when you say adopt this, mean the what Mr. Nash is, what Stevens.
Right, I'm saying to you. Right. And the other thing I heard, and I have other opinion, but is that why send people to a committee when you're going to go do your own thing? It seems like a waste of time, okay, especially when they spent hours going over this and days going over this, and that's what I'm hearing. Also, from the small courts, I'm hearing if you adopt this methodology, a lot of small courts are not going to be able to function, not going to be able to have facilitators. We don't have the resources, and so this is a big problem, and I'm very concerned about that.
Fair comment. Mike?
Hi, Judge Conklin, Brian McCabe, whenever I can have an opportunity, I'd like to speak.
Okay, I just turn to Mike Roddy, and then we'll come back to you, Brian.
Thank you.
Has there been, because I can't seem to find it, an assessment of what it takes to do the job independent of how much money we have available? It's always struck me, and it struck me 19 years ago, that what we basically did is took whatever they gave us and figured out how to divide it, rather than looking at what does it take to do the job. And particularly with the new performance standards, I'm concerned about that. That we're going to be held, per se, to performance standards without evaluating what does it take to do the job. And so it's great that we're using a RAS-WAFM type of process that we're familiar with to allocate the pie. I have concerns that the pie 19 years ago and today is inadequate for the courts to do the jobs that we're being asked to do. Now, if that means we're too expensive and they've got to go to an administrative model, so be it. But I'm concerned that we've never had the conversation that really makes RAS and WAFM a much better process of evaluating what does it take to do the job and therefore what is the shortfall for us to do what we think we need to effectively have to do it. So that piece concerns me, and at that point, that's where I'm willing to step back and say, maybe we endorse the recommendations, but in nowhere do I see here a recommendation for the courts to determine whether this $40 million or $34 million or $32 million is adequate, or whether we need to go out and seriously advocate for more resources, because we've all talked about it, but nothing's ever happened.
Judge McCabe?
Thank you. I too, have received a few phone calls on this issue. And as I understand it, what's being proposed today, if adopted, all three recommendations on a 10-5 vote below would, in essence, to maintain the status quo until DCSS finishes their internal review, evaluation, audit, whatever you want to call it, and then go from there, if that's correct.
That's, I'll let Judge Poole confirm that she was there. Before I do that, Chris Volker's had her hand up. Chris?
Yeah, and I've still got some more. I just wanted to make sure I'm correct on that. First is the proposed action away from the recommendation, which would be to adopt the methodology or the process that was outlined today. First, as noted, it affects 40-plus or about 70% of the courts in the state, and affects them negatively, and so they are concerned. Two, there's a presumption that we've proceeded on, which is not quite accurate, and that is that although WAFM was designed to create parity in the allocations for all the trial courts, it hasn't been fully implemented because it's reliant on full investment by the legislature, and we're not there. So we're in a process of attempting to create parity where parity has not existed for years, and at this rate, it's going to take years, if not well over a decade, before it could be realized, assuming the constant in funding each year. So that's a problem. And the problem is we're in an adjustment period created on a formula, WAFM, that doesn't, it departs from the averages, GIPSIS, and is optimal in what it takes to get the job done, just as Mike Roddy was saying. Yet, we don't have the funding, and if we did, we wouldn't be here talking about any of this. Yet, that's the state of the affair, is we're still waiting for the gradual funding to occur, and as David Yamasaki pointed out earlier, we haven't even hit the 260 treading mark, which was, 2 years ago, and surely that number is higher now. And so this, by deviating from the recommendation and implementing the suggested process, in essence, it's going to have an effect of taking away from those who are reliant on WAFM to give them funding so they can equal parity. So it's not a zero net sum, it's a negative effect. In essence, we've got one part of our branch working against the other for these courts. And again, I'm being an advocate for the number of courts that have called me on this, and I want to make sure this body is well aware of their concern. They're also concerned about the 0.3 application only to commissioner and not to support staff. A number of the small rural courts that I hear from tell us that they're completely reliant on those folks in order to get that work done, and that a minimal effect, $10,000, will have an enormous or substantial effect on those small rural counties because they don't have any economies of scale. They have none. And versus courts that are mid, like my little court, it's a mid court, or a cluster 2, 3, or 4 court, are able to absorb those types of cuts, whereas the cluster 1s particularly and some of the cluster 2s have a difficult time making an adjustment. And admittedly so, this is going to affect 40-plus courts. I'm trying to get a handle on really why we're going to or suggesting to implement something now when DCSS, although I count on what Judge Kuhl says as being accurate, that they stand by those numbers because they have to. I mean, that's what they submit to the authorities here in the state and the Fed. But on the other hand, if I heard correctly, they suggested that the courts wait the 1 year until they finish the eval, and then they could provide maybe not so much more accurate information, but additional information and numbers that would aid us in doing this process. I do agree with Sherry Carter that every time we get these charts, every one of us look to our own court, every one of us. There's a parochial instinct that we dart to that, look the number, how does it affect us? But the question really is how does this affect on a statewide basis those courts for the administration of justice throughout California, not in certain areas? And I just remind folks that's why we're here, and please take that in consideration when you vote. I think I've adequately addressed each of the written issues that I jotted down after talking to all the folks, and I'm sure they're listening too, and I hope I've done them justice. Thank you.
Judge McKay, thank you. So I just want to cover a couple procedural things. Chris has her hands up. I'm going to go right to Chris. We have special permission today to eat our lunches in here. So I want to make sure everybody has a chance to be heard on this. I appreciate Judge Kaufman's concern and Judge Heidrich's concern, and that we're not trying to rework the work of a subcommittee. I ask that this come back before us because we do have to make a decision. So that's something we have to do. That being said, Chris, and then I don't know if Judge Kuhl wants to add anything, but Chris, you had a comment.
I apologize if I'm not understanding this, but what exactly is the recommendation? To follow the recommendation or not to follow the recommendation?
What's happened is, and I want to make Judge Kuhl can comment on this too, but there's a joint subcommittee. The joint subcommittee is made up of three different committees. Ours is one of them. Uh-huh. The joint subcommittee submitted the recommendation on page 2, combined page 47. Uh-huh. It's up to us to decide. That's what we're voting on today. Do we adopt that recommendation or not? And that recommendation, you're right, is, I'm paraphrasing, is essentially to make no change to the method being used, to step back and to allow this, as they've recommended, to occur.
So when Judge McCabe and Judge Kaufman says they don't agree with the recommendation today, I think they're...
They do.
Actually, I do.
I don't mean to speak for Judge Kaufman or Judge McKay, but I think what they were saying is a double objection, layer. Your Honor. Yeah. They're saying the recommendations on combined page 47 are what we should adopt today.
Okay.
Right. And I don't mean to speak for Stephen, but I want to clarify something. I asked Stephen to present today. So we have the information that was presented. I made it clear to Stephen, and you may disagree. I don't think Stephen was advocating. I think Stephen was presenting the work of the subcommittee. So there may be a perspective that there was Stephen's is the only voice in the room being heard, and that, for instance, DCSS should be in this room. I appreciate that. I'm not saying anything more than we needed the information to make the decision, and I think that's our task today. Judge Kuhl? Anything you want to add, Rebecca?
Chris, and can I ask my question? So Stephen, as usual, does a great job of presenting. Thank you, Stephen, and explaining everything. My question, or that's not even a question, it's what I'm struggling with at this point is reconciling the fact that we have made a conscious decision as a branch to consider workload. And here we are with making a recommendation. I understand the reasons why. It's all clearly and well laid out here. But I'm really struggling with the fact that we've got the workload that has shifted from the coastal communities to the Inland Empire. So we're functioning as an Inland Empire court. We're functioning, and as a Central Valley, there are many of you in this room, you know, we're functioning with the workload and not the funding. So what's come before us today is let's forget WAFM and RAS for now. We're going to continue to do it based on the historical funding, based on some comments that have been descriptive today, and I understand them. It would be a disruption to the communities that currently get the workload. I mean, currently get the funding, but don't have the workload. The workload has shifted, and I'm quite bothered by the fact that the branch has made a commitment to consider the workload and make funding decisions based on the workload. Yet here we are, and I'm not negating all the work, and clearly there was a lot of work that went into all this. But here we are making a recommendation to not consider the workload. And I get the realities that 40-some courts are out there and would be affected. I get that. But there's the same reality on the other side, all those courts that have the workload and haven't been funded. So
and
I'm concerned.
Chris, and I'm sorry.
Concerned.
I was looking at different names. Any other... comments.
I just want to say that I think that I would support adopting the recommendations of the subcommittee. I would add if there's additional concerns that we talk about, one of the things as far as if there were courts that needed money, that they're talking about the shifting, that was part of what the subcommittee added in. But additionally, we talk about perhaps recommending an ad hoc committee that the Judicial Council selects, made up of some commissioners and affected courts. Because I think this is a unique opportunity because it's not really our money that we're redistributing. It's federal money that goes down. That it's a very unique opportunity to create something that may use money more effectively, that looks at performance standards, that does some things that makes this system, the California Child Support System, that's a partnership between the Department of Child Support Services and the judicial branch, the premier system in the United States. I mean, I think that if that's what we want to say, people get the monies in their pocket, how do we do that? How do we do it efficiently and effectively? We could do that, but the only way we do that is if we take a step back and say, let's create a group that gets everybody that's impacted at the table with some of our experts who are child support commissioners and create that program separate from the workload assessments and other things, which would be part of being addressed in that. But I think that there were, and if you go on the websites for each one of our committees, there are attached all of the letters. They were mostly in opposition from the courts that were considered by the subcommittee. But I would just urge that we adopt it for the work that was done. And if we think we need to add something additional, that we do talk about stepping back, looking at the real numbers, what does it really take to do the job? And we may say as a branch, you know what, it's not worth the money. go ahead and create an administrative process. I mean, I think that those big questions have never been asked, and we should really ask them and answer them in a really effective way.
Okay, I'm getting different messages right now. Some of them saying I'm very hungry, but I also I don't want to break the flow of this conversation. Sam, did you have a comment, or did I see? And then I want to go to David, and then I think we've covered.
Well, I guess I was a little too forward about thinking, and it came out a little bit. But I'm wondering if one of the reasons California is 49th is the money isn't going to where the workload is.
Can I? I'm sorry. This is Anna Maves. I'm the program manager of the AB 1058 program at the Judicial Council, and I just want to clarify about the 49th ranking. All 50 states plus tribes are measured on 5 federal performance measures that they all compete with each other for federal funds, and one of the federal performance measures is your cost effectiveness. So how much it costs how much money it costs to collect a dollar of child support, that's the federal performance measure that California has been ranked 49th in. So it's been difficult for state DCSS to go back to the legislature to ask for additional state dollars to draw down additional federal dollars, when that would only decrease California's cost effectiveness. So part of what state DCSS is doing in their review of the program is trying to identify how much it actually costs to enforce child support cases and go back to the legislature and say, this is how much it costs. We've been underfunded. And here's what additional dollars will do to help improve our other federal performance measures. So this is why it's worth investing back in California's child support program. And also currently, when California receives incentives from the federal government based on federal performance measures, currently California's legislature, they're keeping those dollars. They're not reinvesting those incentive dollars back into the child support program. So that's another strategy that Alicia Griffin, the director of the child support program, wants to go back to the legislature and ask for them to reinvest those incentive dollars back into the program and draw down more federal dollars.
All right, thank you. I tell you what, there's two or three other people that want to be heard. My proposal at this point is we take 5-10 minutes at the most, grab lunch, come back in, finish up these comments. We're going to consolidate the rest of the discussion. I think we can get that discussion done in about 15 or 20 minutes. I know many of you have shuttles to catch, so we're trying to shoot with our 2 o'clock deadline. So let's take a break. We always say that, and we wander around chatting. That's a great thing to do. But if we keep it at 10 minutes, back in your chairs with your food, and then we'll continue this discussion, and then I think the voice will be heard, and we'll take a vote. All right? Thanks, folks. 10 minutes. Planes and shuttles to catch. So the discussion also is an efficient one. One thought, and I'm not going to make it a formal motion at this point because I want to give folks the chance to contemplate, is one is that we simply do not adopt the recommendation, but we're not opposing it. We're sending it back. We go back to the Judicial Council and propose that we are committed to a workload-based, and I'm just paraphrasing, model, but we're not ready yet, and we don't have sufficient information to get there. So rather than take the position to adopt the recommendations, we simply go back to the council and we say, from our committee's perspective, we believe there's more important work to be done, and we would send it back to the joint subcommittee for that work. But that being said, I think Rebecca wanted to speak first, and then I believe there's another voice, then David. Rebecca, then David.
Okay, so I just wanted to make a couple of comments. I was on the subcommittee, and so I did support the recommendation when Stephen presented it to the subcommittee. That being said, there's some obvious holes in the process, but it was a starting point. I think it's important that we support the child support program. I think it's important that we support our partners, DCSS, and the agencies, all the agencies we work with, but you know, when I hear that we're 49 out of 50, I have to step back because that was not well defined to the bigger group. And when I hear that, you know, it's based on, you know, what it takes to get the dollar in the hand of the person who needs it, I agree that that needs to happen, but I don't think that piece is our role. I think we stop at some point before that. And I think that until we agree on what our role is and where it starts and stops, I think we can't even address things like evaluating what our caseload, not our caseload is, but our workload and what the total might be. So I think that the other thing is that I was opposed to using DCSS's numbers, not because they weren't more accurate, because I think actually they were, but because this is our branch and our workload and what we have to do in our own four walls when we're dealing with our cases. And I think if our numbers are bad, we need to fix them, and we need to put some emphasis on doing that. One of the things I think that everybody needs to understand is by doing nothing or by adopting the recommendation today, we will have courts that continue to leave money on the table, and we will have a problem asking for more resources, period, until DCSS does their thing or we decide to move in another direction. And as a consequence, we will have courts that can't make basic payments like staff costs, like salaries. I mean, we're not talking about supplies and other things. We're talking about salaries. So, you know, the thing is that, yes, there were a lot of courts affected. That's one of the reasons we looked at phasing in things so that it wasn't this knee-jerk reaction. But the fact is that there are some people, some courts today that can't make the payroll, so to speak, and are having to take it out of their other funding. So it works both ways when we don't take action. So that would be my comment, and I'll turn it back over.
Thank you, David.
Thank you, Judge. I also wanted to just take a minute to thank the work of the subcommittee. It was a lot of work. I can only imagine all of the details that had to be produced and reviewed. And I think the subcommittee, the joint subcommittee, is moving in the right direction. That was obviously the basis for WAFM, which is what we use today. But the other thing about WAFM is that the fabric of WAFM was really based on some really important threads, and one of those threads happened to be an assessment of what it takes to do the work. And, you know, touching upon what Mike Roddy had said, we haven't done that work just yet. We don't know how quickly we should be processing cases, and just looking at the information as it relates to my own court, we're barely hanging on with the resources that we have right now. And if we had a sustained reduction, we would not be able to comply with the terms of the plan of cooperation that many of us have been asked to sign. So I think we're moving in the right direction, but on the other hand, there are a lot of activities that we're going to be seeing here going forward. One is the consultant that DCSS has retained. They're going to give us an idea of what they believe things should be done differently, and certainly with more data within the judicial branch, we'll be able to get a better idea of what we should be doing differently or the same. And at the same time, many of us, 25 of us, are implementing new case management systems, and that really is a game changer for all of us, and it's going to create a lot of opportunities to do things electronically. Maybe that as we get our hands around the new technology and start implementing processes that coincide with what those features bring to the different courts, the timing of it, maybe in a year or whatever, that it takes for the consultant that DCSS has retained and perhaps the additional work that we're going to be assembling in this body to really come to the table with all of the factors to consider and figure out how best to go forward. So I like the idea that perhaps we not necessarily move forward with recommendation other than the fact that we believe that it's a great starting point and ask for additional information before we, embrace it in its entirety, because I think there's a little more information that would be helpful for us to rely upon before we go forward.
Thank you, David. Tanya?
I have a couple of things. I've been around a long time, as has Mike, and I absolutely echo what he says about the fact that we don't know what it costs to actually run these programs. And I remember very distinctly when the 0.3, the 0.7, the point what, to some degree, I think many of us at that time at least thought they were absolutely arbitrary numbers, and then they were based upon a pot of money that was designated, but there was no real mechanics, and I'm pretty black and white when it comes to this kind of stuff. I want to know what it takes and what it's going to take to do that. The other concern that I have, and I did stop to Stephen for a minute, and I can support the recommendation or the fact that we take no position on the recommendation, but I think that all the statistics and all that information that was brought forward could actually get even expanded, because one of the things, you know, to Chris's point, that her caseload's gone up like crazy. But for the courts that are going to lose, and of course I'd be one of those, and I supplant our program to a very large degree from a money standpoint, has that caseload shift really shifted from those courts, so that if you're going to take that kind of a dramatic approach down the road, yeah, I think we have to factor in that impact. That's just really all.
All right.
Jeff.
Jeff, thanks. My eyes aren't great. Sorry, go ahead.
Am I correct in interpreting recommendation number 3 as beginning a process in the immediate near future? 1 and 2 seem prospective in nature, but 3 appears addressed at setting in place a process to adequately use and make sure the funding is utilized on a year-to-year basis so that it's not left on the table, it's used fairly, and when you look at the program in its entirety, it doesn't look like there's excess money there because it's been reallocated. And if that's the case, is that worth considering?
I'll leave that to one of the...
So that stands on its own in a sense, because what it deals with is the problem of trying to get all the money spent. So however you determine what the allocation is at the beginning of the year, the committee felt there needed to be a process by which, if a court is not on track with its ongoing funding to spend all that money, that there be some process for reallocating mid-year. And Rebecca had raised that as an issue early on, and the court execs who know about these things had taken that on. And I think there was unanimous agreement in the subcommittee that, I believe, that process be put in place regardless of how it's determined, how much money you get at the beginning of the year. Does that make sense?
It does, and okay. It seems like it's beneficial now.
Judge Good?
I'd like to make a motion. I'm looking at combined page 47 at the recommendations. I'd like to suggest we modify paragraph 1 so that it says allocate funding using the historical funding methodology for this year, but devote the resources necessary to develop a workload allocation funding methodology for allocating resources as soon as possible. I would accept 2 and 3 and include them in my motion as they stand. Let me say why I say this. It seems to me that we don't have consensus on an alternate to historical funding. So I don't think we can do anything other right now. 2, this committee has led the charge in the branch for doing workload allocation funding, and it has been well received by the rest of the state government. It makes sense, and it seems to be more fair. So while I don't think we're there yet, and I echo what everybody said about the extraordinary amount of hard work that's gone into this, while I don't think we're there yet, I think we should aim to be there as soon as possible. I think that some of the comments that have been made suggest that we may not be that far off. Stephen said at one point, it caught my ear, that if you shift the funding floor a bit, you can get to where it's 27 courts losing money, 27 courts gaining money. I don't know if that's the right number, but it seems to me that I don't know whether tinkering is enough or not, but I would leave that to a subcommittee that does not include me, thank you. I thought one of the things that Sam said made a lot of sense, which is if you think about it, if we're 49th in efficiency of dollar being collected, it may be because we're not giving the money to the counties that need it. Because if you take a reductio ad absurdum, if you gave all the money to Alpine County and they managed to collect $2,475 from the one person in their county who's the object of all this effort, we would be 55th out of 50 people, out of 50 states, because there'd be horrible efficiencies. So it may well be that our position is reflective of the way we're allocating the money. So for all those reasons, I think we can't in good conscience recommend doing something that's 19 years old and continuing that as if that makes sense. But I don't think we're ready to adopt an alternative. So I think the first one has to say we need to move to workload allocation ASAP.
Okay, so I just want to try to be as procedurally proper and appropriate as Judge Earl always was.
Okay.
When we do this. So there's now a motion, and I'm trying not to paraphrase. I've written down something, and so let me try to paraphrase and see if Judge Good, if this is what this committee is committed to. Continue to allocate funding using the historical funding methodology for this year.
Right.
Devote resources necessary to develop a workload funding methodology as soon as possible.
Right.
Insert that, and then continue on with coordinate with DCSS, as is in paragraph one. I mean, I think what we're trying to get across is we're committed to a,
yes, I think that's fine,
a workload allocation model, but we're not ready to get there yet.
Well, I actually, the one thing I wouldn't say, Judge Compton, is I would not say review the funding methodology at the conclusion of the DCS program review. I would stop by saying coordinate with California DCSS on their current review of funding allocations for local child support agencies, period. And
all right.
I end that recommendation there.
Okay.
And then I would accept two and three.
All right, Sherry?
And I would take friendly amendments from somebody who knows more what they're talking about.
This is a friendly amendment.
You always make friendly amendments to my motions.
I think that's a really good idea, but I would suggest that we have 1 year to do it. We've done that with other, and I would say for implementation of fiscal year 17-18. And listening to what Rick said about how self-help can come into play, I would hope that the committee, and somehow the motion may want to include that we look at the self-help funding, that I don't know on what basis that's been, you know, provided, because that may be a piece that needs to be looked at as part of this review. So, you know, I could support that motion if they were given 1 year to do it.
Okay.
And would encourage us to also look at the self-help.
And so you would just point out that this, at the way it's here, is for the 16-17 year. So Sherry's comment is appropriate. This would be 17-18
right.
To go off a year.
I accept that as a friendly amendment.
All right. Mike, Roddy?
We're still not addressing what does it take to do the job.
Well, that's...
In 17-18, we're going to have revised 3-year DCSS caseload numbers or court numbers or whatever, but we're still not addressing, is it 50 million? Is it 80 million? Is it 20 million that the courts need to do this job? Somehow we've got to incorporate an assessment of what does it essentially take, just like we did in WAFM, so that we know what the gap is. Otherwise, we're just moving the gap around.
Mike, I agree with you that we should. The reason I didn't include that is this. We, more than any other branch of government, have figured out what it takes to fund the judicial branch because we've done RAS, we've done WAFM, we've done judicial assessments. We can put forth a zero-based budgeting proposal to the legislature and the governor, and we still get, at best, 71% of what we need if you look at the WAFM number. When we merge, we're going to be at 71% of our need. So I think the need question is interesting but irrelevant because I don't think the need question is going seriously to affect the amount of funding we get. I think what we have to figure out right now is how we divide the funding we get. I think we should work long-term to be able to state the need rationally. I have no doubt about that. But I just despair of how little attention is paid to our need when we state it as accurately and rationally as anybody does anywhere in the United States.
Okay, so go ahead.
Did Sherry second his motion?
She made a friendly amendment, so now, and the amendment was accepted by Judge Good. So is there a second to the amendment by Judge Good with the friendly amendment?
This is Judge Earl, I'll second.
Okay, so there's a second.
Okay,
any?
But I had a question, too.
All right, Judge Cope, and then Judge Kaufman.
I just want to know if that's strong enough language. I don't see a reason why this is waiting for DCSS. And you had mentioned language about that. And if you're satisfied that that's strong enough to point out that we can coordinate, that's great. But I don't see a need to wait, and I'm fine with it either way.
Just as a point of information, DCSS is going to be finished with its review, as I understand it, in July of 2018.
2 years from now. Judge Kaufman?
Just a procedural question. So there's a recommendation on page 47 or
correct.
Page 2.
Right.
Now, is that before this committee?
It is before the committee.
Okay.
And we have not taken a vote on the recommendation on page 47. We have, in fact, modified the recommendation.
There's a motion to modify it. And a second.
Correct.
So if I or somebody else were to move to adopt 1 through 3 on page 47, what was the procedure in voting? And lastly, is Mike making a motion or friendly amendment or what? I mean, I'm just trying to get procedure.
Sure. So one way to proceed is to immediately take up the recommendation as stated on combined page 47, and I'm just speculating that would not be adopted by this, and then we would have the recommendation of Judge Good, which is page 47 as stated, and we would vote to adopt that. If your concern, Judge Kaufman, is what's before us on page 47, we need to vote on.
And then also, Mike, are you making a motion or not?
He said no, and so Mike Roddy was nodding his head no.
I just want to know what we're voting.
I agree. We need to keep the record straight. That's what we do on all our jobs.
Is there a scribe that can restate the friendly amendments to I heard Judge Cope, which I strongly endorse, and that is that while we want to collaborate and cooperate with DCSS, we should not let the tail wag the dog. We should take care of that assessment of the workload. We definitely should continue to work with them, but I think we need to have that assessment ourselves.
Judge Good.
I think the way we've modified one has this effect. Accepting what Sherry said, it would be to continue to allocate funding for fiscal 16-17 using the historical funding methodology, by 17-18 have developed a workload assessment methodology for allocating the funding. We will coordinate with DCSS on their current review of allocations for local child support, period. I think we want to coordinate them with them. I want to know what they're doing. I want to know what they're thinking. But I don't want to be governed by something that's not going to happen for 2 years when we can develop a funding methodology.
How do you coordinate this with WAC and the FAMJU?
They've made their own recommendation.
We're going to be the workers.
Absolutely. We'll appear before the council. I'm not procedurally sure who does that, but we'll appear before the council and tell them this is our recommendation.
I'm sure ENP will tell us how to do
it. I'm sure they will. So I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jeff.
This situation is a little different than WAFM in the branch, because that's money the branch controls.
Right.
Here the funding is in part from DCSS and in part from the federal government. And reading this, the way that recommendation number one is phrased, my assumption, which may or may not be accurate, is those agencies that are contributing significant portions of the funding to this are asking us to wait. Is that incorrect, correct, or what?
Judge Cole.
So my understanding is that DCSS is provided money by the federal government and provided a smaller portion of money from
the state, whether that's general funds or not, I don't know. Some state, more federal. They receive that, and then they provide a certain amount of that money to the Judicial Council. And so what we're talking about is how we divide up the money once it's been provided to the Judicial Council.
Right, but if we alter the service levels that we're providing in various places that affect their operation, do they want to be part of that discussion?
Well, I think it's fair to say that Alicia Griffin said she wanted us to coordinate with them as they did their review of work, and that that ought to inform what we do in some way.
Okay. So we have now a motion seconded before this committee. I had some comment. Judge Kaufman had some concern. I believe that the way we're proceeding is appropriate because we're taking the recommendation, we're modifying it, and we're voting on it. So I believe that procedurally that's the appropriate way to proceed. If not, I'm sure I'll be counseled, if not lectured otherwise, for our next meeting. So I'm going to call the question unless there's any further, anybody on the phone or any further requests for discussion. So
Judge Kaufman?
Judge McCabe?
Yeah, so we're voting on recommendation 1, 2, and 3, including 1 as amended?
Yes, so 1 as amended, 2 and 3 as stated in the recommendation.
Thank you.
I appreciate the clarification. So I will initially ask for a show of hands, and if that term is not determined to be clear in the room as to the vote, then we'll go person by person. So as far as adopting the recommendation rather than a voice vote, which is hard to decipher over the phone, please, a show of hands, adopt voting in favor of the modified recommendation. So in the room, 17 hands are raised in the room out of, and on the phone, I'm sorry, but I will have to ask for voice votes. Judge McCabe? No, he's just an advisory. I believe, Judge McCabe, you would not have a vote, correct? Because you're just here on behalf of. So, Judge, I apologize, Judge McCabe. Judge Earl?
I had my hand up. I didn't think you could see it.
We're always watching. Judge Smith, are you still on the phone? All right, I don't believe Judge Smith is now on the phone. Any other members on the phone this afternoon?
Yes, Judge Saunders, and I vote aye.
Have I left anybody out?
Yes, Jeff Lewis Kings, and I vote affirmative.
Voted yes, and I'm told that Judge McCabe does have a vote. Judge McCabe, do you have a vote?
Yes.
Yes, okay. And so could I just, we're clear on the record that there were some hands in the room that were not raised. I wasn't sure if that was an abstention or a no. So I've now asked for the aye vote. Any no votes?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
5 no votes in the room. I'm sorry.
6.
Raise your hands again, please. 6. 6 no votes in the room. Anybody on the phone? I believe everybody on the phone has voted. Any no votes on the phone? Hearing none, motion passes. Thank you all very much for the discussion. I know we have more work to do on this, and we will. So, in the interest of time, I'm going to turn to Rebecca now. She has a very brief update and an action item. And then I think I can summarize the discussion items, and we can probably defer that discussion until our next meeting, though I'd like you to know where we're going. Rebecca, this is now taking us to item 5, the update from the Funding Methodology Subcommittee. I'm the chair. Rebecca and I are co-chairs, along with Colin, the JCC staff advisor, and Rebecca.
And Judge, I don't believe we do have an action item. I think this is going to be...
You're correct. It is a discussion item.
Just an update, and we will bring back an action item at the next meeting. But to update everybody as to what's going on with the Funding Methodology Subcommittee, we met in December, and we have included in your materials on combined page 82
an updated work plan with the main changes being that we have added discussions on new judgeships, staffing complement funding, so that we can address how that works with the WAFA model as we go forward. Also in 2016-17, to add in the review of the funding floor calculation. That process, while it was set, there was no refresh or revisit to it, so we added that in. And then special circumstances case funding. And so those three items have been added to the work plan. So that's just an update on that piece. Conversations also were started on three areas, the first being update schedules. While the group has updated information such as average court executive salary, Bureau of Labor Statistics, salary-driven and non-salary-driven benefits, et cetera, what has not been updated throughout the process is the operating expenses and equipment to make sure that it's accurate and keeping up with where we're at. And so we're memorializing those update schedules. We're adding in that piece, and we'll have a recommendation for you on that at the next meeting. We are also addressing expenses that were not previously considered, either because they didn't exist at the time or because they didn't have any expenses in them, and so they just a decision wasn't made on them. So those are being reviewed right now. There are also some revenue sources that were not previously considered for the same reasons. And then lastly, there was a small group of accounts that were actually both considered and not considered for the WAFA formula, and it's because the items like such as like security have two components to it, one that was considered, one that wasn't considered, or attorneys, et cetera. So we're going to have a whole package for you at the next meeting, but that's just to kind of let you know what kind of conversations are happening. And so, Judge Conklin, do you want to add anything to that?
No, I think
it's a very brief summary. I got us back on schedule.
You sure did. Look at that. 2 minutes to two.
Okay.
Any questions or comments on that updated item?
Oh, we did set a small work group as right. Well. Do you want to comment on that?
Sure. We have a small work group. Judge Holland, Mike Roddy, and Tanya, to start to, and I want to be very careful the way I phrase this, because I know by even bringing up this, it creates legitimate concerns, but to start to consider civil assessments and their impact upon WAFM. And it is not an attempt to change WAFM in any way. It is simply recognizing that we have to address that issue, and we're starting down that path to develop information. I thank Judge Holland and Mike and Tanya for getting us there. But it's an information gathering process. Tanya, did you want to add any to that, or Judge Holland or Mike? They've been kind enough to take on a Herculean. Mike's looking at me like, what'd you say?
In a mobile crisis, sorry.
Sorry, okay.
No, go ahead.
So that's what that's going to be. So what this is, in a broad perspective, addressing is our annual agenda. The annual agenda is still being developed. When we come back in March, which is our next meeting, on March 10th, we'll have the annual agenda on the on our actual agenda to adopt. I'm working, obviously, it's going to be pretty consistent with what our annual agenda is every year, except I think it is going to be important, as we started off the conversation with Martin this morning, especially concerning the $30 million and the innovative grant proposals, that I think, among other voices, our voice is a significant one to be heard in the development of the procedures of how to deal with those funds. And so this committee is, as somebody I think earlier said, this committee is at the forefront of the budget and discussions and developments, and I think that's an appropriate role for us, recognizing other committees also have a voice to be heard. So if you have any other concerns or suggestions for our annual agenda, please email me. I'm not the greatest in responding. Judge Kaufman can attest to that, because he's been waiting for an email from me for 2 months, and he reminded me of that when I walked in the room this morning. So I'll try to be a little more prompt with that. I do appreciate, I'm rather new to this committee, and you have been very warm and helpful in your reception. I'm looking forward to a challenging yet productive year. That being said, Rebecca?
Just for anybody who is interested in sharing their concerns, questions, perspectives on civil assessments, you're welcome to call Mike or Tanya or Judge Holland. Actually, Judge Holland said call Mike or Tanya. And we are having a meeting to start the discussion on February 5th. And so feel free to share with us.
So any other matters to come before the committee today? Any other concerns? What I'm going to do in just a moment is formally adjourn us so we can go off the air. And then please, transportation issues, Stephen's here, and he has announcements as to where you meet shuttles and that kind of thing. Anything else for the good of the order this afternoon? Anybody on the phone want to make a comment?
Very quick question.
Judge Good.
We got a list of dates of future meetings. Can we put those in ink or are those in pencil?
They're in dark pencil. They're on Thursdays. I recognize, I'm not trying to be selfish, but I think coming from Fresno, I have a pretty typical commute time that a lot of you have. In other words, it kills an entire day. So we try to keep our agenda from 10 to 2 to allow time to come into town, time to get back home again. We try not to go overnight agendas. But again, our schedule should not dictate important agendas. We're setting them on Thursdays. That appears to be a day that works good for everybody. Did Judge Good, you have a concern about any of those dates? Okay. Anything else? Thank you all so much. We're adjourned.